It's time for Twit This Week in Tech. Oh, I love this panel. Amy Webb is back, author of The Genesis Machine, Our Quest to Rewrite Life in the Age of Synthetic Biology. Also founder of the Future Today Institute and our favorite futurist. She joins Connie Guglielmo, who is also very important in our lives, editor-in-chief at CNET, and dear friend Dwight Silverman. This is going to be a great panel from the Houston Chronicle. Yes, we have to talk about Elon. He says, I'm not buying that Twitter thing. What went on? What went down? And what is the future for Twitter? Also, two big data laws passed in Europe. What does it mean for all of these big tech companies in the U.S.? And the hacker who stole 1 billion records of Chinese citizens. Is that story true? Amy has some thoughts. It's all coming up next on Twit.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Twit. This Week in Tech. Episode 883. Recorded Sunday, July 10th, 2022. More data than sense. This Week in Tech is brought to you by Indochino. If you've got a big day coming up, getting the perfect look is no big deal with Indochino. Get $50 off any purchase of $399 or more by using the promo code TWIT at Indochino.com. And by UserWay.org. UserWay is the world's number one accessibility solution, and it's committed to enabling the fundamental human right of digital accessibility for everyone. When you're ready to make your site compliant, deciding which solution to use, easy choice to make. Go to userway.org/twit for 30% off UserWay's AI-powered accessibility solution. And by 8Sleep. Go to 8sleep.com/twit for exclusive 4th of July savings through July 10th. And if you're listening after July 10th, use the same URL to check out the Pod Pro cover and save $150 at checkout. And by Worldwide Technology. With an innovative culture, thousands of IT engineers, application developers, unmatched labs, and integration centers for testing and deploying technology at scale, WWT helps customers bridge the gap between strategy and execution. To learn more about WWT, visit WWT.com/twit. It's time for Twit This Week in Tech, the show we cover the week's tech news with wonderful people, excellent journalists, who will help us understand what the hell Elon Musk's up to. Amy Webb is here. Always exciting to get her on, CEO of Future Today Institute, and a futurist. Hi, Amy.
Hey, Leo. How are you?
I'm great. Welcome back. You were in Amsterdam. How fun.
I was in Amsterdam and Italy. And then before that, Aspen and San Francisco. I've been gone for weeks.
Oh, were you at the Allen & Company shindig?
No, that is Sun Valley. I was at the Aspen Ideas Festival and then at a World Economic Forum meeting.
Actually, probably much more interesting than Allen & Co.
Yeah, you know, I just don't look good in a puffy vest. So I feel like I wouldn't fit in to the Allen & Company shindig.
You know, I watched the press looking through the chain link fence as they arrive in their Escalades in their puffy vests. And I think, that just doesn't look like much fun. So
Did you watch the show Succession?
Yes.
By any chance?
I love
it. Pretty funny.
Their parody. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And they were all in puffy vests, actually. That was pretty funny.
They were. There's a whole scene where they sort of make fun of the vest.
Yeah. And the name tags, and the billionaires don't want to wear the name tags, but you got to wear the name tags. And oh, I love Succession. I love, you know what I realized? I have a strange fetish for watching billionaires in action. And actually, this show is going to play right into this. But first, let's introduce the rest of the panel. Connie Guglielmo is here. She is editor-in-chief of CNET, the big boss. Hi, Connie.
Hello.
Great to have you. Happy Sunday. I appreciate you being here on a Sunday. I know this is a difficult time to do a show, but we really appreciate it. Also, all the way from Houston, our good friend Dwight Silverman, who's been on Twit for decades, it seems.
It has been decades,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
At least two.
His new newsletter site is authory.com/dsilverman, AUTHORY.com. How's that going?
It's doing very well. It's a great, it's a service, that you pay for, and they, you essentially can post everything you've ever written from any source.
Ooh, I like that.
And it displays it nice. Oh, it's great.
So all your Chronicle columns and stuff were there, and
yes. And when the brief stand I was at Forbes is there, and
oh, that's great.
It's great. And this today, my print column moved over to the Sunday, Houston Chronicle, which is good. It publishes on Friday. So I'm happy to kind of be back home in the technology part of the Houston Chronicle.
You keep trying to retire.
it's
not happening.
It's like, I don't feel retired. Although this is funny. I'm taking a social media break for a month.
Oh.
I'm not on Facebook or Instagram. The only thing I'm doing is when I have a new column, I post it there. And it's really weird because I've been doing social media nonstop since it started. And really before social media started with BBSs and blogs, and I've never stopped, and I'm not doing it this month, and it's really weird.
Getting going through a social media withdrawal is tough, but everybody I know who's done it feels like they got a new life. Like suddenly the birds are singing, the sun is shining, the world is good.
Yes. Well, you can't in July in Houston, you can't really go outside for very long. It's 102 right now.
Oh,
and
golly.
In Austin, it's 108.
Mm.
And, but you know what I found? The thing that has frustrated me most about it is that I really miss, like when I find a really good story, just sharing it on Twitter or on Facebook and not necessarily commenting on it, but not just being able to find something, say, hey, look at this. And that's the thing I miss the most is kind of sharing stuff. But I'll be back probably in early August.
Like the Terminator, he will be back.
That's right, I'll be back.
So, you know where I'm going to start here. I have to. I don't want to, but I have to. Elon Musk says, I am not buying Twitter. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. To which Twitter responds in the form of Chairman of the Board, Bret Taylor. The Twitter board is committed to closing the transaction on the price and terms agreed upon with Mr. Musk and plans to pursue legal action to enforce the merger agreement. We are confident we will prevail in the Delaware Court of Chancery, which is a little medieval. But now, Ev Williams, one of the founders of Twitter, tweeted, oh, come on, Brett, I know you feel like you have to say that, but can't we just let this all go? Amy, it seems to me, and I've seen some other people say this, that is a kind of one billionaire to another statement, sort of. Like, oh, don't worry about the little people whose stock price has been depressed by these shenanigans. Let's just let Elon off the hook.
Right. So I will remind everybody, people who have listened to me before know this, but for those of you who I haven't met yet, I dropped out of law school right before starting, so I'm not a lawyer. I was qualified to go.
You got into law school, but you didn't actually go to law school. So that's like
I made a last minute decision not to go.
Smart woman.
Yeah. Anyway, so here's my two cents on what's happening. There is absolutely a lawsuit, and that is because you can't jack around another. You know, if you're going to kill a company, you have to kill it dead.
yes, you know, that's what they say. If you're going to kill the king, you better not miss.
Right. So this is not a mostly dead Princess Bride situation. And there are repercussions. This is a publicly traded company. Board members have fiduciary responsibility. The leadership of that company has a responsibility to its shareholders and its employees. And if an outsider comes in and files paperwork, which he had to do, saying that there was an intent, a good faith intent to buy, you know, that is legal paperwork. And to renege on that at this point, that there should and will be repercussions without a doubt.
Yeah.
Can we also just say that, like, let's just like call it for what it is. Elon Musk likes the drama.
He's a troll.
All of this is happening.
He's a troll.
All of this is happening around the same time that it's come to light that he's got twins.
That's a good one.
One of his employees.
Yeah.
So like, you know, and then got into a crazy, ridiculous argument on Twitter with somebody about the, oh, it was Nick Cannon. The two of them are broing out about underpopulation on the planet, and that's why they're spreading their seeds so generously.
Thank you, Elon. Thank you for blessing us with your progeny. U.S. birth rate
is there is something. This was part of the what's his face, the horrible Epstein. There seems to be a common thread among men of a certain that there's this like compulsive need to spread their seed.
Yeah.
And part of the justification for that is underpopulation. This is a crazy ego driven.
Can I tell you what the real, what's really the subtext to this? And it's kind of like replacement theory, that the dumb people are reproducing at a fast rate. So we who are smarter than them must keep up. Otherwise, all that's left is dumb people. And so it comes from, I guarantee you, because I know people like
this. No, I think
you're right.
It
comes from this point, this sense that I am a superior race. And so it is my obligation to spread my seed far and wide. So it has nothing to do with a fertility slump, I guarantee you. It has
that's what they're saying.
It's crypto racist is what it is. Crypto, rich personist.
Crypto classist.
Classist, there's the word.
Classist, yeah.
There's just a certain amount of hubris here.
Hubris, yes.
Anyhow, going back to the...
All the isses.
But there is a legal responsibility that as a signer, he now bears. And the folks who are suing on behalf of shareholders and investors and just like company chaos are absolutely within their rights and are probably going to prevail.
Yeah.
In court, if it's not settled outside.
Connie, go ahead.
And I was going to say, there's a $1 billion breakup fee at stake here as well. And I think, I don't know what others feel, but the beginning of this whole Elon Musk wants to buy Twitter, if you were taking odds from folks who follow Elon Musk, we all knew that that deal wasn't going to go through, especially when the stock prices for Tesla took a hit and his wealth was affected. And, you know, you can say whatever you want about what you want to do and what your feelings about it are. But at the end of the day, to Amy's point, you have to put down some legal commitments and you have to put down some money. And then if you feel that you want to, you know, jerk around the SEC, which is what some people thought Musk was doing, and jerk around Twitter, that's all well and good in Twitter and it plays to the drama and you like to be part of the drama. But there is shareholder accountability and there's money. There's a $1 billion breakup fee at stake that Elon Musk, you know, doesn't want to pay. So that's, you know, it's all about money at this point.
It's not $1 billion. We want $44 billion. You said you were going to give us $44 billion, and by God, you will. Although, you know, these things take time. It's got to go to court. There will be lawsuits back and forth. The Delaware Court of Chancery does move a little bit faster, apparently, in issues like this to protect, in particular, the corporations registered there like Twitter. So I suspect there may be an outcome quickly. But there's been a lot of interesting speculation, especially about this $1 billion breakup fee. He could make a lot more than the $1 billion breakup fee just by a pump and dump scam on Twitter. He bought 9.25% of Twitter stock without revealing it, breaking SEC regulations at the time. Still no punishment on that, although they're investigating. And then announced, even after he bought 9.25% at a reduced amount, then announced he was going to buy it, thinking perhaps the stock price now would go straight up and he could sell all that stock. Did not happen. In fact, you're not alone, Connie. Not only did pundits not believe he meant to buy it, the market didn't, because at no time did Twitter's stock price go anywhere near what Elon was offering. In fact, right now it's $36. Elon's offering $54.20. That's exactly the market saying, yeah, no, that's not going to happen. Otherwise, the price would go close to $54.20, wouldn't it?
You're absolutely right. Yeah, nobody believed it.
Nobody believed it.
And so, you know, we're just left with the mess, basically. I mean, I know people who work at Twitter.
I feel so bad for
them. Twitter has been struggling trying to expand its membership. They have their challenges and issues. And you really don't need, you know, a boy billionaire with, you know, an ego about what he wants to say, screwing things up. And so now it is put up or shut up time. Will he ultimately buy Twitter? Obviously, that's not going to happen. So it's really a question of how much does he have to pay for screwing around with a publicly traded company? And also, remember, he's been in trouble with SEC many times. He's done this to Tesla shareholders, right, saying that he would take a buyout bid, and then the SEC slapped him with a fine, and then all of his tweets had to be reviewed by the SEC. So he's had a lot of pent-up anger at the SEC. And at the beginning, when this was all announced, people thought he was just trolling the SEC some more.
Yeah.
So
we'll
see. I have a question. Because Brian and I, my husband and I, had an argument about this whole thing over the weekend.
Wow, you guys are really interesting.
I know, right?
Whatever. Lisa and I are arguing about the, you know, what color the paint should be on the house. And you're arguing about Elon. That's good. I like it.
We had a knockdown, drag-out argument about this. And he is an Elon apologist. No matter what.
See, there are those.
I kept asking questions.
He's a stan.
He's a total stan. And no matter what I said, it was, but he disrupted the auto industry. And without him, there wouldn't be electric cars. And he disrupted, he disrupted space. And it was like no measure of just practical facts applied. And then I said, well, you know, let's think about this in terms of like Jeff Bezos, who gets no passes. Everybody, there's nobody to defend Bezos. And I would argue that Bezos has actually been more influential in changing global economic structures, among other things. And Bezos makes mistakes. He has no slack. Elon keeps doing ridiculous things, and there's just legions of people ready to defend him, including my husband. And I can't grok why. Maybe it's because I'm a woman. I don't know. There is no way for me to get into the headspace where I see the net positives, you know, that this guy is wielding at this point.
It's the state of the world today, isn't it? That half the world goes, what's the deal? Why do you like this guy? And the other half says, he's God. And it's not, it's just not, not just Elon, I might add. There's other people with oranger hair. And it's like those of us who are in the skeptic camp, just, I don't understand it. I don't get it.
Well, Elon has kind of, in the past, has relied on his instincts as to what needs to be done and has had successes with it. SpaceX is a success. He has disrupted space. Electric cars, that's a success. And all of them kind of were the result of him going, you know, I think this is the way it should be done, and I have the resource to do it, and we're going to push for it. But that's kind of the same thing he did with Twitter. His experience on Twitter is not what your experience and my experience is on Twitter. It's one of the reasons why he's so obsessed with spam bots. You know, we occasionally see spam bots on Twitter and we block them and move on, but he's got millions and millions of followers and it's a completely different universe for him and he's obsessed with them. So what he did with SpaceX and what he did with Tesla, he was trying to do the same thing. It was his instinct. I'm going to buy this company. I'm going to make it the open-ended town hall for the world, which was actually one of the things that Twitter talked about, in some of its founders talked about, the pulse of the planet early on. And he says, I'm going to do that. I'm going to save this. But when it turned out to not be what as easy as he thought it was, and it's a completely different beast. And I like what Matt Levine said in his Bloomberg piece, that he started it out kind of tongue in cheek, believed in it, but got bored, and now he's walked away from it. I think the same instinct that brought him to Tesla and SpaceX brought him to Twitter, but it failed him.
And I should point out, and you might want to give Brian the book Ludicrous by Edward Niedermeyer, which is about Elon Musk and Tesla. Niedermeyer had an opinion piece in the New York Times early in June. When Elon Musk dreams, his employees have nightmares. He interviewed 100 Tesla employees to do the book and really points out that as much as Elon, you know, took credit for SpaceX and took credit for Tesla, he was a pain in the butt for the employees. Mr. Musk reported that he had slept in, this is Niedermeyer writing, slept in Tesla's factories during this period, which he called production hell. What he left out of his self-aggrandizing was the reality for his employees. His presence brought no real manufacturing expertise to bear, just the overbearing pressure of a boss whose public shaming was punctuated by declarations like, quote, I could be on my own private island with naked supermodels drinking Mai Tais, but I'm not. And I have to say, you know, you hear the same stories about Elon sitting in on all-night sessions discussing the nozzles on SpaceX Falcon Heavy, but he's not a space engineer, and I'm sure his presence at those meetings was more of a burden than it was an asset. His money is welcome.
Let me put in a sort of supportive plug for an outside-in perspective on things because, you know, most of the time I'm in boardrooms with executives or their C-suites, and even very successful companies become very myopic over time. So it can be useful to have even a senior executive who's just an incredible leader, who doesn't have domain expertise in that industry, lead because you get a valuable outside-in perspective. But I think there's a maturity issue here. And there's a vast difference between an outside-in perspective where you may lack domain expertise, but you're an incredible executive. You're just an incredible chief executive. And what we're witnessing, which is just like, you know, billionaire boy immaturity, hubris stuff. And, you know, I don't think we should be celebrating somebody who got a hair up their rear end and decided they'd, you know, take over a company and then like change their mind. And in the process, you know, created all kinds of chaos in the wake of that. That's very un-American if you think about the structures that hold up our economic functions in our society. Like we should not be celebrating that.
I just watched two great TV shows. One about Adam Neumann at WeWork called We Crashed on Apple TV.
Yeah, it was super good.
And then The Dropout, which is all about Elizabeth Holmes and the failure of Theranos. And both of them shared the same, and I suspect Elon and both of them probably looking back to Steve Jobs, who did turn this kind of out-of-the-box thinking and driving personality into a real success at Apple. And I think there is this kind of culture in Silicon Valley that it's that the unruly CEO is an advantage, not a disadvantage, just as you said, Amy. But there's a line. Steve Jobs kind of stuck to his knitting. Although I remember when they were making the Fremont factory for the Macintosh, he insisted all the machines be painted in a particular shade of, what was it, red? he really liked that color. Elon, this is an article from 4 years ago in the Intelligencer. Tesla factory workers are in danger because Elon Musk hates the color yellow. He refused. He had kind of gray lines on the assembly line that were hard to see instead of the traditional, you know, yellow stripes, caution stripes, because he doesn't like the color yellow. Lane lines in the factory floor are painted in shades of gray. Tesla denies it. He also is into not having too many signs and doesn't like the beeping sounds forklifts make when they go in reverse. And as a result, it's very dangerous, according to the Intelligencer. It was very dangerous to work in the Tesla factory. I shouldn't laugh.
Well, I want to go back to what Amy just said about why people admire, why they admire personalities. And that's really what it's about, right? We live in a society now where the cult of personality and people are entertained by someone who's different and outrageous and, you know, will say crazy things, right?
Yeah.
Some people definitely love it. But there's a difference between being a celebrity and being a business leader who has, you know, thousands of employees' lives and livelihoods, you know, under his thumb, you know, or under his color choices, if you will, and being somebody who's a visionary. So we can say that Elon Musk had a definite vision about space and about electric cars and was able to follow through. Not easily, right? Tesla wasn't the slam dunk success that people, you know, thought it would be. And so he had to invest and he had to see through some of that vision, but not all of his, I wouldn't call him the most business savvy, certainly not the most ethical business leader, or even the most forward thinking one. We saw that he wants to cut or is in the process of cutting a lot of his staff. And he's asked everyone, you know, post or mid pandemic or post pandemic, wherever you think we are, to go back to work 5 days a week or turn in your badge. Insisted
they come back.
So there's a difference between what a personality is from an entertainment value. And we definitely see that with him and others in the political realm and outside of it. And then there's the, okay, let's talk real now. And there is no real talk when you get to that point about what are you doing that makes sense? Why is it sensible? Why should we follow you? Why should you get a pass? Certainly. So it's just, we live in a world where people, and maybe your husband is one of them, just wants to put his blinders on about, well, he did these good things. And, you know, it's like, you know, somebody who's convicted of a crime, the neighbors, oh, but he was so nice.
He was such
to his
a
mother.
Nice, quiet guy. Right? Yeah.
I think that the point that you're making about personality is absolutely on. And I think a facet of that is speaking up in a way that some people feel like they can't. Being able to jostle the status quo in a way that people feel like they can't. I mean, and people compare him to Tony Stark. And I think that there's a certain amount of reverence for Tony Stark, mm-hmm. you know, for not having any superpowers, but through the sheer might of his own ideas and the will to carry through, you know, that,
however,
that he's sort of
Iron Man
challenged.
Is not real.
No, but I can. But
wait, what?
I, you know,
what?
I'll tell you who I don't hear defending Musk. I never hear. Or let me put it this way: the group that tends to defend him tends to be pretty homogenous, right? Yeah. It is white men,
tech bros.
Yeah. I don't. I well, so but that's my husband's not a tech bro, but he's a white man, and I just, when I hear him talk about it, it sounds like it's almost a yearning for. It's a character. It's a character, a personality that I think people looked up to because they're doing things that people feel like they can't on their own.
It's the great man. I agree with you. And that's why Trump, of course, has his adherents. It's the great man hypothesis, too, which we really believe, which is that Napoleon or Alexander the Great or Thomas Edison or Henry Ford, these great men stand up above the crowd to lead us into the future. And it's through their force of personality that they are able to do great things that the rest of us can only admire. I think that
right,
that
and
has
it's
been
hard
pretty
during
much debunked,
the,
hasn't it? The great man hypothesis.
It. I mean, yes, but the problem is the paradox of the present. It's very hard to decouple the attraction that you feel for that personality at that moment, and then sort of, you know what? So Jack Welch, if you think back to GE and Jack Welch and his disciples, in that moment, he was hated. And there's some similarities here. He killed GE. Stock prices way up. Yeah, total cult. And in the aftermath of all of that, you know, he's been vilified, not a good guy, you know,
there's a book about him called The Man Who Broke Capitalism.
It's by David Gelles. It's a terrific, terrific book. You should read it if you haven't.
And unfortunately, capitalism has survived. But Welch got a $417 million severance package from GE. So.
Right. But the problem is during the time, everybody was like, oh, this guy can do no wrong.
Yeah.
You know, no apologizing.
Oh, there were
for
all these books.
Horrible, horrible, terrible behavior. But, you know, with some distance, we see things differently. And I think in time we will. You know, it happens all the time, right? To every character throughout history.
Well, isn't that part of that cult of personality, though? We love to build them up and knock them down. It's the plot.
And sometimes they knock themselves down.
Well,
which is what
they give us
Elon
the ammunition often. Yeah.
Right. I have a question about the $1 billion termination fee.
Yeah.
And, you know, Connie talked about this, but I'm curious about this. Why would Twitter make the statement, you know, basically Elon says, I'm dropping the deal, and Twitter says, no, you aren't. We'll see you in court. Why not just say, all right, give us the $1 billion and go away and let us go about our business. Why did the? I mean, it's probably going to end up with a settlement.
I'll tell you why. $36.81. That's the Twitter stock price after this mess, and it's directly due to Elon Musk. And Twitter wants to be made whole. $1 billion ain't going to make it whole. Connie, you're nodding. You agree?
Yeah, I was also going to say, I think that's just all legal chatter, too. They have to show that they have a good faith effort to want to continue the deal. And they believe that he has not acted in good faith by walking away from the deal, complaining about bots and so forth. And so I think that's just legal maneuvering. I'm not a lawyer either. I did apply to law school as well and decided to be a journalist. So I have that in common with you, Amy. But from what I understand, it's that, you know, you have to this is all about good faith efforts, right? So there's a good faith effort to close the deal. That's what Twitter is doing now. They're insisting. You're right. The $1 billion doesn't cover the harm that they've felt. But also, Elon Musk doesn't want to pay even the $1 billion.
No.
This is why he's terminated the agreement.
Interestingly,
right?
So, though, Connie, his public, and by the way, I always have to remind myself, it's legal to lie to the press, to the public on Twitter. His public stance is there's more than 5% of bots. That's unacceptable. In the letter from his lawyers, and I'm going to say the name because I love saying it, Skadden, Arp, Slate, Meager, and Flom. In the lawyer from his letter from his lawyers, did I mention they're Skadden, Arp, Slate, Meager, and Flom? They didn't mention the spam bots. They just said Twitter has been non-cooperative and has not given us the information we've asked for in order to assess this problem. They are, in fact, not giving any evidence that it's not 5%. They're not saying it's more than 5%. They're just saying Twitter's not being cooperative. That's a different grounds. And by the way, a grounds I don't think he's going to win on, because remember, this deal was as is. He waived the right to all the due diligence that would normally accompany this kind of merger. He waived it. So, and Twitter, I think, has been, I think a judge will say, has been performative. They gave him the fire hose. They gave him every single tweet, half a billion tweets a day. What more could you give him than every bit of traffic on Twitter? I think they have been cooperative. So I don't, I think he's not going to prevail. This is going to be a problem.
I mentioned the Matt Levine article called Elon's Out on Bloomberg, and in it he puts a lot of that into context and talks about three different scenarios as to what he thinks is going on, and incorporates a lot of that letter.
Levine is great. Levine is really good. Yes. I trust his. Yes. He was an investment banker. He did M&A. He knows this stuff.
And his, you know, of the three scenarios, he basically thinks that that Elon did this as a joke.
Yeah.
That it basically he was swept just away. Having fun, yeah. And he got swept away in it. And I think I bet you anything that there will be a very short period of negotiation, and they will settle this quickly.
It's fascinating. Do you think it's possible also that we're underestimating Elon, that he was being smart about this? There's one theory. This is from Yahoo Finance, Aaron Prater, how Elon's bizarre Twitter takeover saga could just have been a cover for him to sell $8.5 billion in Tesla stock. Maybe he's sly as a fox. Maybe this was all a clever ruse. Nobody believes that.
I think it's worth us. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, Elon Musk loves drama. Yeah. He loves to be the center of drama. And I think Dwight's point is correct, that he started this as kind of a joke. Well, Elon, will you come and save us and save free speech and whatever and buy Twitter? And he's like, yes, I will do that for you.
Yeah.
But then, you know, the rubber hits the road and it's like, wait a minute. Like, there's money now.
I think it's at stake. Yeah.
I think it's worth zooming out and asking what the next order implications of all of this will be. I do some work with government, and I hear often people saying that statesmanship is gone. So the way that, you know, government and politics is about politicking now and less about policy, the politicking is easier, the policy is hard,
and people
just don't behave the way they used to.
Yeah.
I think there's something analogous to what we're seeing in the world of the newer world of business. There's disrupting industries that have been reluctant to respond to emerging technologies, you know, and forces. But then there's also disrupting sort of the diplomacy of business, or just how we've operated. And another way to look at this is, you know, do other people start to have ideas about manipulating or influencing how companies operate? If Elon comes for let's not forget there was Dogecoin. We've seen patterns before. You know, what if others emerge and start to do the same thing? The chaos that ensues as a result you know, changes the landscape in a way that I don't think is positive. I think there's positive disruption, and I think there's just like disruptive in a bad way disruption, right?
It's not thoughtful, and it doesn't have any future thinking. It's really just, what can I do right now to get people's attention, to get people's vote, to get people's money? And it has no planning.
I think Connie's sort of opening salvo and all of this is right. You know, we're living in this age of sort of high drama all around.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, the next order impacts of that aren't purposeful or thoughtful. And I worry a little bit about the positioning by what's left, right? Regardless of the place where it's happening.
I hope, Connie, to your point that what's left is people who want to disrupt things get away with the disruption if sometimes it does have a positive impact and we can change laws and whatever. But if you're disrupting things and it doesn't work, you have the SEC, which, remember, forced him to step down as the chairman of a Twitter because of his tweets. He paid a $20 million fine, which to him is probably the spare change in his pocket. But nonetheless, there are enforcement vehicles. And so people will push and we allow them to get away with it unless there's a recourse. And I mean, this is what the January 6th hearings are all about, right? You can say whatever you want, but at the end of the day, do some people go to jail for insurrection or manipulation? So will there be repercussions against Musk beyond he might have to negotiate with Twitter on a larger or smaller $1 billion breakup fee? That's where the change is going to, you know, have some impact, but only if the institutions are willing to go through the trouble to pursue.
Well, and that's the grave risk, because we're teetering right now. And if there is no consequence to behavior like this, people will lose faith. They'll lose faith in the rule of law. They'll lose faith in our institutions, in norms, and then all bets are off. And by pushing it to the brink to see what's going to happen, yeah, I hope there are consequences. But if they're not, the consequence is far greater. And I think that there's a serious risk that there will be no consequences for any of this behavior, whether it's January 6th, Elon Musk, or anything else. And if there are no, the SEC feels pretty toothless. And I think Musk thinks he's going to get away with it for sure, right? And that's bad.
Right. I think accountability.
Then you lose faith. Then right. The American people will lose faith in our institutions. And that's when it's all over.
Is the SEC toothless or just slow? In other words, they did ultimately take action that caused him to...
$20 million fine.
And step down as the chairman.
And insisting that he have a lawyer look at all his tweets, which is obviously not happening. And what is their response? I think we better investigate that. They're underfinanced and they're undermanned.
Yes. But
and this is the bigger problem. Our institutions are not prepared to handle norm breakers to this degree. We didn't expect anybody like Donald Trump. We weren't prepared for that. We weren't prepared for Elon. The SEC is not prepared for somebody who doesn't care what you or I or the SEC thinks. We expect some level of norms. And when somebody goes that far, I think, like Mark Meadows, we freeze. We don't know what we...
I don't, you know, I'm not willing to write off the SEC just yet.
I hope not.
I think it will be real interesting in the next few days to see what kind of words come out of there. You know, there's a lot of criticism right now about Merrick Garland and him not moving fast enough in the DOJ in the January 6th investigations. And I think that he, like a lot of lawyers, is very careful.
Yeah.
And you don't mount that case until you know you can win it. And I think that the SEC, I want my SEC to be like that. I want them to, when they step forward, they've got it.
If
that's
prudent.
What they're doing.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's fine.
But they need to give some sign that's what's coming.
Well, they don't even need to do that, but they need to at some point act. Remember, the point of the SEC, the whole reason the SEC exists is so that people have faith in the stock market, that there is an insider trading going on, that the information you as a individual investor are given is the same as everybody else, that it's an equal playing field. And as soon as people don't believe that, forget it. The whole financial system relies upon that trust. So the SEC has a very important mandate.
Well, yeah, and I think they need to speak up quickly on this.
Yeah.
And let's also look at Musk. He made a bid for a company, and now all of this drama has ensued. And like you said, from the very beginning, Leo, the market didn't even believe it. If Elon Musk goes to make a bid on another company...
Yeah, he's ruined his reputation.
What are they going to say? I mean, the talk about Musk and, you know, bankers and everyone interested in him is if he takes SpaceX public, they would like to be part of that deal. But I just don't see him knocking on another door and everyone welcoming him in.
He has damaged Tesla's value as well. In fact, its estimates, not completely clear, but, you know, all of the... a lot of the money he was putting up was borrowed against Tesla stock on margin. But Tesla stock price, if it goes below, it's thought somewhere around 725. It's very close right now. If that margin would be called, Elon would suddenly have to put up all that money. I mean, look, you can't say he's not a brave fellow. He has put up.
There are bankers on the lines. So this is not, and there's another part of the story, which is the financing on this was not just his. It wasn't his.
There were a lot of people were in this. Yes.
There were banks including that were involved. So
the sovereign fund of Saudi Arabia.
Right. So I have to ask where all of these other stakeholders are.
Can you imagine
in the middle
phone
of
calls?
This walking away, and was it his unilateral decision to walk away? And if so, like, how much is that really screwed over all of these other potential future investors for other venture, you know, SpaceX or whatever? There are next order consequences here that I just
And what of Twitter? What happens now with Twitter? Let's say, all right, Elon walks away. It's over. Twitter's going to just continue on as always. By the way, there's also, I think, a fairly credible story that this was the plan all along. Jack Dorsey, remember, endorsed the Elon acquisition. It said that Jack put in Agrawal as the CEO, kind of not the ideal guy to run this challenging company because he knew Musk was going to come along. He wanted a weak CEO. The board has no dog in this hunt. They have very small amount of Twitter stock. Jack has the most with only 2%. There are those conspiracy theory minded that said this was the plan all along. To palm it off on Musk. Now what? If it fails, now what? Twitter?
So the business model for this company was never salient. And I'm one of the OGs. So I've been on it since its service launched.
Yep.
And I loved using it up until probably 2 years ago when things changed. But the business model never quite worked. It was never going to make sense for this to be ad supported. They did some M&A activity, but then, you know, when they acquired Nuzzle, for example, and rather than monetizing that, which they should have done because it could have been a terrific product to work alongside it, they killed it, integrated some of it and made it worse. So, you know, the price was already inflated. I think the stock price was already inflated. And what was the Twitter has a fraction of the number of MAUs compared to others in its category. So, you know, there's that.
Apparently, Elon is planning to down the puffy jacket and fly to Sun Valley soon.
He was there. And it was there's no media inside, but from what people heard who were there, like he kind of got grilled.
Ah, see, that's what I was wondering. Standing ovation or boos? So boos, interesting.
I mean, I don't know that people were actually booing, but I know that this did not go well for him.
It shouldn't go well for him. That's disruptive to the markets in general. It's disruptive to the whole system. Fascinating. I for one hope Twitter survives. I think Twitter. Yeah, it's not a good business, but I think it has huge value to our society. Should it be a public interest corp? What should it be? I don't know. It should somehow survive.
Well, my original idea years ago was that news organizations should pool together and turn it into a 21st century version of Reuters or AP. And monetize it, but also keep it open for everybody. I mean, that to me would have made the most sense. And at that point, this was before Twitter went public. That would have been more of a utility play. And I think that would have been a better longer term plan.
Maybe Jeff Bezos will sweep in and turn it into a public benefit corporation. And I don't know.
I think he's distracted with other things now.
Bezos made the deal for the Washington Post at the Allen & Co. Confab some years ago. So that's where those deals get made. Maybe Elon will come away with something besides a bloody nose. All right.
Yeah, I just looked it up. Reuters has a story about Elon Musk captivating Sun Valley. Captivating him.
Well, you got to imagine if he walks in the door, he's the object of a lot of interest.
He was interviewed by Sam Altman, who's the CEO of OpenAI.
Yeah.
And it was.
Wow. I would love to be a fly on the wall.
One of the quotes was, "I'd hate to be Twitter where you have to take this guy seriously." Anyways.
I think Twitter needs a new board, they need a new CEO, and they need to be somehow funded in such a way that they can be a public benefit corporation and not
a new mission as well.
A new mission, yeah.
Yeah.
Because they do, I mean, there's still, I have to say, since the Elon thing, I spent a lot more time on Twitter. And there's so much valuable information there. There's a lot of garbage, but there's a lot of valuable information, and you kind of are in control of it. And I think since their acquisition of Nuzzle, I mean, to that point, Amy, they've actually done a good job with the topics.
Oh, the new blue service. I was a power user on Nuzzle. I had made hundreds of custom lists.
Oh, me too. I loved it.
And I was using it as a way of aggregating signal data. And
I was sad.
What's resulted is totally, I mean, I pay for the Twitter blue service.
It's a shadow of the original.
It's a shadow of what it used to be.
Nuzzle. Yeah. I agree. But it's something. And I have to say, the top articles section, and now they've added people. Besides people you follow, they've added a Nuzzle-like people that the people you follow tab, which is exactly the same because I guess I follow the same people who follow the other people who follow the same people. But anyway, I think that's a value that recognizes the importance of Twitter as kind of a news feed, as the dial tone of the
internet. This is a product that basically has not evolved, not seriously since its launch. So there's a certain also, I mean, I had some conversations with them about why they weren't evolving. And the answer I always got was, well, the DNA of the place was, let's just build it and see what happens. There was no real planning. And you know, that may be true in the beginning, but if you're trying to grow and scale a company, at some point you have to do longer term planning and you have to be able to execute against that plan.
Nuzzle was created by Jonathan Abrams, who was creator Friendster. And
he's have you ever met him?
Oh yeah,
he's
interviewed
awesome.
Him. Awesome. Yeah. I love
that guy.
Yeah.
He's always like slightly too ahead of the market.
And I don't think when he made Nuzzle, I don't think he was trying to make a huge business. I just think he thought it was kind of cool and interesting. And that was what I gathered. We interviewed him. I think he was on Triangulation some years ago because I was a big Nuzzle
he's
fan.
Very, very smart. He's a great guy. Yeah.
I still can use top articles like I use Nuzzle. In fact, I still can use Twitter as I use Nuzzle, which is essentially to see what's going on for the shows and to bookmark important stories for the shows. And it's still a good feed of news if you follow the right people and all that. So I hope Twitter survives this fracas.
I certainly miss it in the couple of weeks where I have been off of it. And as I mentioned earlier, I don't get a chance to share stuff, but I also have had to try to find alternate ways of finding the news when you're covering and paying attention to tech. It's kind of the best way to get there. And I've suddenly I'm subscribed to a lot more newsletters than I had been before. So
interesting.
That's helping.
That's the new way, isn't it?
Yeah, but it's still slower. You know, you wait for the newsletter to come to you, right? And with Twitter, you know, it's just there in your feed.
I find myself watching TV or doing stuff, cooking, and I'll have Twitter scrolling just to kind of keep an eye out. Doesn't everybody feel like that? That's the buzz. That's where things are happening. And if something happens, you're going to know about it first on Twitter.
Particularly in tech, I think you got to remember that most people are not on Twitter, and that's not how they find out about things. And
no,
so,
but
you know,
every news organization. Go ahead, Connie. You were going to say something.
No, Amy was going to say something.
Oh, Amy was going to say something.
I'm happy to follow her.
I was more just going to say I think the difference in the year 2022 versus the year, whatever, 2006 is just diffusion. We don't have a small concentration of networks.
Right.
All the journalists that I'm friends with have, you know, moved on, and you've got Discord, you've got Keybase, you've got all of these other places now, and vehicles. Like, media has consolidated. The channels for distribution have changed, you know. And so I think it's a little harder to find those important pockets of what's happening and the people who are talking about them.
But Twitter is it. I mean, you don't go to Facebook. I mean, I don't. No one I know goes to Facebook for news. I actually, normal people probably do in great numbers.
So Twitter, to both points being made, is a great place to find out what's going on if you follow certain people. But then you, first of all, create your own filter bubble, right? So that's an aside. But there is no one place to go to find out, you know, everything that's happening. And the advantage of a place like Twitter, at least at the beginning, was that it allowed people to know what was going on as quickly as insiders did, right? I worked for Bloomberg for many years, and they had the headline service, which was basically Twitter, right, before.
But you had to have a very expensive Bloomberg terminal to watch.
Correct. You had to pay for that information, and then it was all about making money, right?
But knowing they made money on it because people needed it. They wanted it.
Ahead of the market, right? And so the potential for Twitter to tell you what's happening in the world quickly and to have that information disseminated, you know, equally to anybody who subscribes is there. But obviously that business model and also the use of social media has been so corrupted that you almost have to hit a reset button, I think, on what it needs to be. And I agree that if there was a moment in time where it could have been a utility for news services to be that wire service to the world, free, that people could find out what's happening and they would see quickly, that might have changed some of the way public discourse has gone on in this country.
Well, that's a missed opportunity.
We're not there.
Mike Bloomberg made a little bit of money on those terminals. What do you think that the terminal as important and successful as it used to be?
I mean, it is to people who are setting up trades and want to act instantly on news, because in the world of the stock market, and others can speak to this as well, it's about, you know, having a, you know, microsecond advantage when you're buying something, if it's going up and if it's going down. So there's a lot of automated trades in that system,
right,
set up to react on news. So in terms of what's happening generally in the world, I think you can find out that, you know, the former prime minister of Japan was assassinated on Twitter. You don't need a Bloomberg or Reuters terminal anymore to do that. But from a financial perspective, mm-hmm, where seconds or milliseconds or fractions of a second matter with these automated trades, there is an advantage, which is why people still buy.
$2,000 a month, $24,000 a year. It seems like Twitter missed a boat there. They could have had something. Speaking of boats, by the way, wonderful having the three of you. I love it when we can get great smart people on. Dwight Silverman, formerly of the Houston Chronicle, still, I guess, of the Houston Chronicle, authory.com/dSilverman.
Still writing there, yes.
Still there. They won't let him retire. Try as he might. Connie Guglielmo, editor-in-chief of CNET. Okay, don't get better than that. Top person at CNET. And Amy Webb, futurist. And always a pleasure to have all three of you on the show. I'm going to be on a boat on Saturday. I'm a little worried. We thought COVID would be over by now, but we're going on a Twit cruise with 100 Twit followers, which is great. Can't wait to meet you all. And I thought, well, you know how it is on a cruise. You like to dress up a little bit. I thought this is a good special occasion. So I went to Indochino, our sponsor, and I got myself some nice stuff. I'm not going to show it today. I have showed it before, but I want to surprise people on the fancy night on the boat. I've got a beautiful blue, I think purple velvet, like tuxedo with satin lapels. I got some beautiful Indochino shirts that I'm going to wear. I am ready. And if you are getting ready for a special event, maybe you've got a wedding coming up and you want to be in a wedding party, or maybe you just want to look your best for date night, I want you to look at Indochino. You'll look great. You'll feel confident. And you'll enjoy that big day without fussing over your clothes. The secret is everything is custom made to your exact specifications and measurements. And I have to tell you, even, you know, sometimes when you get all dressed up, you feel uncomfortable. If it's custom made for you, you don't. You feel like you're in your own skin. You look great, but you also feel great. And with Indochino, you could choose every detail on a suit, on a shirt, on a dinner jacket. And no, you're not paying a king's ransom. In fact, you'll be really, I think, pleasantly surprised at how inexpensive, completely custom tailored clothing can be. Every suit made to your exact measurements. You can customize every detail. We chose the lining. We chose the buttons, the lapel shape, the monograms. And the best part, Indochino suits start at $429 and shirts from just $79. And they fit perfectly. I haven't even opened these shirts yet, but I've opened others and I know these are exactly the same measurements. This will be perfect. It'll have I can wear a necktie without choking out because the collar is exactly the right size. Things like that. Indochino offers completely custom fitted shirts. Yes, they have casual wear. You can get a complete wardrobe personalized to your style and taste without spending a fortune. And they're always adding new stuff, which makes it really fun to go to Indochino.com and check it out. Stay in trend, stay in style. It's, I think the best way to describe it is relaxed yet refined. The new suits are out for spring and summer, new spring pastels. If you've got a big day coming up, you just want to look good. Getting the perfect look is no big deal. Indochino, Indochino. In fact, right now you're going to get $50 off any purchase of $399 or more. Just use the promo code TWIT. So we'll help you out in this new look of yours. Indochino.com. $50 off a purchase of $399 or more. Indochino.com. And don't forget to use the code TWIT so they know that you saw it here. And if you're on the cruise with me next week, look for a guy in a sharp purple tuxedo. It really looks good. I know when I say purple, it doesn't sound good. It really looks good, I think. I can't wait. I wanted to be a little bit fun. All right, back to the news. Enough Elon. Spent an hour on that, but I thought, you know, it's a fascinating story. That's why, by the way, I guess if you're saying, you know, that everything's heading towards this kind of drama, it's because we in the press love it. It makes great headlines. It drives traffic, right, Connie?
It does, but I would be happy for some quiet time myself.
No, not going to happen. Never going to happen, I'm sorry to say. Amy was in Portofino when the Dobbs decision came down, and I apologize for harassing you in Italy, Amy, because I really wanted to get some women on to talk about that.
Yeah.
There is, of course, a lot of consequences in the tech world to this. Google has now said they are going to stop tracking location tracking when you go somewhere sensitive, like say an abortion clinic. That is a real problem because that information is being sold and fairly easy to get by third party data brokers. And I can just imagine. In fact, the President Biden. The White House put out a warning to women saying, if you're in one of the states where abortion is illegal, stop using period tracker apps. Is that really the way to solve this? Or maybe we need some better privacy protections. The EU, at least, is doing something about it. The EU has passed now two new regulations, the DSA, the Digital Services Act, and the DMA, digital? Oh, now I've lost track of the two different regulations. The DMA. These are they're related, but did cover different things. The Digital Markets Act, the DMA, is going to require companies like Google to stop self-dealing. For instance, it's going to affect Apple and Google's App Store, for instance. The DSA is a little bit, and at least among geeks, a little bit more controversial because although it seems to mostly be aimed at interoperability, making messaging apps, for instance, interoperate. If you have 45 million monthly active users, so you have to be a big guy. So it's about WhatsApp, Apple, companies like that. But there's some concern that the DSA, Oh, no, I'm sorry. The DMA is gatekeepers. So confusing. Is there some concern that this interoperability solution will impact end-to-end encryption? Amy, I know you're a fan because you mentioned, once again, Keybase, which was all about end-to-end encryption, and you're using it as a messaging system. It is end-to-end encrypted messaging, right?
Right. So here's what I, you know, China and the United States are very far ahead of the rest of the world in certain areas of tech, for example, artificial intelligence. And I like to say that the EU's primary contribution in terms of innovation is like policy and regulation. So this has been coming for a while, but as with other, especially privacy related regs, you know, enforcement and compliance has always been a real challenge. And we already saw that with GDPR. What would it actually take for the DMA portion of this to be enforced? I think the European Commission has set up some type of task force with a couple dozen people. But, you know, they don't just have organizations within Europe and businesses. It's anybody who's dealing in any type of information anywhere around the world and in that territory. And so while it's certainly laudable to make everything interoperable, the question really becomes like, how do they actually enforce this? Will they have the people to do that? I think they're also setting up some type of commission on or special transport, some type of special group on algorithmic transparency.
Yeah.
So again,
which is crazy. You know, they somehow want to know what's the algorithm.
Right.
And,
you know,
that's
from a, I think this is going to result in, you know, lots of lawsuits. Certainly the big tech companies challenging this or trying to mitigate some of the damage. There's also an advertising piece of this. I think the DSA is now banning any type of content that could be considered advertising to minors.
Yep. As well as dark patterns.
Dark patterns and also PIIs. So any type of identifiable information that might be used to target you, let's say in a Facebook ad or an Instagram ad based on your gender or your location or things like that. And that's not even an opt-in. I think it's just an outright ban. And it also includes politics. So I'm not sure what the fate of political advertising now looks like in Europe going forward. So it's a pretty big game changer.
Yeah, a monkey wrench in the business model for so many companies.
Right.
And even though it's only EU, as EU goes, so goes. We've learned from GDPR. So, I mean, well, how many cookie banners did you see this week? You know, that's not a law in the United States, but because of GDPR and European regulations, every site that has European visitors has to adhere to this law. So this is dramatic. And by the way, the fines for the DSA are 6% of your worldwide revenue, up to 6%. It could be significant. And more if you fail, double that if you fail to comply. The DMA is a mere 4% of global revenue. So CNET, let me ask about CNET, Connie. I know you're on the news side, but still, you're global, right? You're not going to put up a banner that somebody coming in from the EU, oh, sorry, you can't read our stuff. That would be bad for a lot of reasons.
No, I mean, we, like everyone else, has to put up a disclaimer asking people to approve cookies or how their information is collected or shared. So that, you know,
that's GDPR right there.
That's GDPR, and that's an extension. These two new, the DMA and DSA, I think of them slightly differently. The DMA is about competition and protecting competition from protecting companies who want to compete in digital marketplaces. And the DSA, to me, is more about consumer protection and right. Some of the negative effects of, you know, data collection there. But nonetheless, you know, Amy's spot on. You can do whatever you want. And I applaud the EU for taking the lead. These are complicated issues. And if it takes years to levy fines or litigate, you're not going to change behavior right away, right? People are not going to stand up and do the right thing.
But GDPR did. I mean, people, even though there hasn't been a lot of... It took a while, but yet, well, it's only a few years. And there haven't been a lot of big fines. So some people are saying, well, they're not going to enforce it or who cares. But it has an effect. People pay, good actors anyway on the internet pay attention.
Now, I'm glad that these issues are being discussed, because you started this question talking about the implications of the U.S. throwing out Roe v. Wade and what effect that has on data collection. And we're seeing that. What a mess, basically, has ensued. And who's interpreting it and what information? And is your phone, is that data you? Or now is that a weapon that can be used against you if you're looking for health information, the most personal health information that you could possibly look for? So it's just, we're at the beginning of an absolute and utter mess in terms of how these regulations and laws come into play. And who's the winners in all of this? The lawyers, because there's going to be a lot of lawsuits.
Lawyers. See, you guys, you should have gone to law school. The lawyers always win. Actually, the happiest lawyers I know are former lawyers. So I'll just throw that out there. President Biden, I don't know how effective it will be, but put out an executive order, as I mentioned, urging the FTC and other executive entities to examine and reinforce data protection policies. I mean, it's an executive order. It's not an act of Congress. And it could be more performative political poppycock. But it's definitely an issue. And maybe Congress needs to act. But again, legislation, and we have this conversation a lot. We have people on all areas of the spectrum on this subject, including some who say that nothing government could do will be of value. I'm kind of more, look, maybe government's not perfect, but this is the society's chief way of expressing its need from these tech companies. And letting the tech companies decide is the worst idea. So we got to do something. But
well, there's an interesting paradox that's going to have to get resolved, because up until Roe, tech companies were very much on the side of, not controlling, not allowing a lot of transparency into the flow of data and information. And suddenly this is, this is like COVID in a way, because it's forcing them into a sea change overnight. There are states, including I think the state of Indiana and South Carolina, that are actively now working to create laws that will punish anybody for traveling out of state for an abortion. Trying to use some of the human trafficking, I think, laws as a backbone for that. And part of how they're going to do that is by using license plate scanning technology, and then to the extent they can purchase or get a hold of those third party data, to track people using mobile phones. So I think this is going to force companies finally to come to terms with who exactly, are they custodians of data? Who gets access to the data? How transparent are they going to be about who's sharing data?
Well, here's an example. This is from TechCrunch writing about the presidential, Devin Coldway writing about the presidential proclamation or executive order. HIPAA is a perfect example of the Health Insurance Portability and Something Act, which protects your privacy of medical records. So that's a federal non-disclosure law. Comes in direct conflict with state-forced disclosure laws. States are saying, no, we need to know, who went to that abortion clinic. That's a federal versus state thing. I don't know. This is going to go on in the courts for years.
HIPAA has been sort of like canon, undisputable.
Yeah.
That is the one thing that nobody is willing to violate.
Except these state legislatures. So we'll see what this is one it's going to be decided in court. And far too much of this is decided in court at this point.
Leo, I happen to live in one of those red states that where a lot of this is going on. And in fact, there's the law here in Texas that anybody can sue anyone else for helping someone else get an abortion, which was essentially taking that and putting it in the hands of civil courts. And it was fairly effective even before Roe versus Wade, and major chilling effect. And the legislators that put that bill forward and voted on it are kind of salivating at what they're going to be able to do when the Texas legislature meets in January. They meet on odd numbered years. And there is talk about going after companies like Google and Apple who want to pay the travel expenses for their employees to go out of state to get abortions. And obviously, in order to find out about some of that, they're looking at data. And it's going to be quite the fight in January.
Wow. And meanwhile,
I don't know if I can I just say one quick thing?
Please. Like, yes, Amy.
Politics aside, this will have dire economic consequences for every single state that is pursuing the edge cases of enforcing or even expanding on this law, or the change in law, change in policy. What are the knock-on impacts? You're going to have businesses, you're going to have changes in workforce. There may be people who decide to stay in the state, but you're definitely going to have people who will look to go elsewhere.
Google has said you may relocate for any reason and we won't deny it. You don't have to.
You'll have people who don't. Yeah. Like, think of the state of Texas. You've got some pretty terrific universities. You know, if you have a choice to go to Rice for medical school or to go anywhere else, you know, because this isn't, there are research related consequences to this as well. Like, I don't think people have fully thought through the long-term economic impacts this is going to bring on their states and communities. So there's in addition to everything else, there was a business case and an economic case to be made for why this was such a stupid, stupid idea. And pursuing it the way now that the states of Indiana and some other states are just tells me that the people who are in charge are incapable of playing out what the future might look like forward. You know,
I would put it another way. I would say, and by the way, obviously, I am in favor of, I'm very much pro-choice. And if I weren't, my wife would kill me. I would say, there is a mismatch. It's an impedance mismatch. You're asking for long-term strategic planning. The legislatures who are passing these bills are not thinking about, and I think actively not thinking about, long-term economic consequences. They are trying to save the lives of these unborn children. And from their point of view, unless they're very cynical, and I'm going to give them credit for not being cynical, this is merely a way of stopping this murderous practice of abortion. Mm-hmm. And so it's a mismatch. You're asking to think strategically. But even if you say that, well, what about the economic consequences, Senator? They'll say, well, it doesn't matter. We're saving the lives of children.
Wait, but this is the result of strategy, a very, very effective long-term strategy.
Yes.
That was master.
Yes.
So that's like the weird paradox here.
But
the,
I'm going to get, but same- should I give them credit though still for, yes, they look at the Republicans have been playing this for 30 years since Alito was put up at, you know, in the Supreme Court. It's clearly a very successful long-term strategy, but I still say, I don't want to say they're cynical in this. I'm going to say they're doing this because they deeply believe in their heart of hearts that abortion is wrong.
But if they're going to come into one of the big conflicts they're going to come into, particularly in states like Texas and North Carolina, where they have actively recruited California-based technology companies. You know, there's a huge Apple presence in Austin. There's a huge Google presence in Austin and in Dallas and Houston. And they have been recruiting them here. HPE moved to Houston. Their headquarters are now here. And they're all saying, you know, we'll pay this. And it was a major effort on the part of multiple governors to get them here. And now suddenly you're going to be saying, well, if you're here, you can't do this action, humane action for your employees. And it's, you know, you talk about economic consequences. Yeah, you're right, because you are going to start having people leave.
Yeah, but that's what I'm saying is they're not thinking about that.
No,
or maybe they are. I mean, Tabby.
They don't care. You know, they don't care. And I kind of agree that at the base of what you're saying, Leo, that they're saving babies. But I also think at this point it's become sport, and they're enjoying the strategy of playing whack-a-mole.
Yeah,
and
I don't know.
I just want to say there's all good points from my columnist, and I agree with all of you. But let's remember, HIPAA is your privacy. It protects your privacy when it comes to medical procedures. And when what we know is when laws are passed, people look for loopholes, right? And ways to, you know, change the way that law was meant to be to suit their own purposes. And so there's going to be repercussions there because it's your personal, you know, health decisions. We've seen that thrown out under the guise of some people want to protect some life and discard the life of others. I don't think it's about saving babies. I think it's about supposedly saving babies, but at the expense of, if you're not going to make exemptions for the life of the mother, rape, or incest, then you're ranking life and you're deciding which life that you want to choose. But so that is not pro-life.
There's a lot of places on that scale. I mean, not every legislature is saying that.
No, but there's definitely now a movement where some of these regulations are abandoned.
No
contraceptives
on
in vitro, whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
So you have the privacy issues around HIPAA, which is established law. And these states are going to start to mess with that because they can or they want to or they're on some sort of a
because we have
zealot.
A Supreme Court that doesn't care about established law, right?
Right. And then you do have these issues about data collection. If this device can now be used as a weapon against you, that has far-reaching implications.
Yeah.
Not just on businesses and where they want to relocate, but how you might want to use this thing in the future. And suddenly purging all of your apps and walking away, and maybe it will lead to terms of service that we can actually all understand, right? Which is, you know, coinciding with what the EU is doing and trying to raise awareness about privacy, right? So it's a messy path that we're on with lots of implications. And it started in the wrong place. I was a constitutional law major before I decided not to go to law school. And the throwing away of 50 years of precedent and taking back a constitutional right is already unprecedented. And so it wasn't well thought through.
They're going to say, oh, no, wait a minute. What about Brown versus Board of Education? We have overturned judicial precedent in the past. Look,
a constitutional right that was granted.
Yeah. I don't want to get in the, I don't want to be on the other side of that argument. But I also, I think it's important to just bring up these arguments against it so that we, you know, I don't know.
Well, I think, first of all, I want to say,
I want to go home tonight, so I've got to be very careful here.
I think Connie and I are sisters somehow from a, what something mother it made sense in my head. It doesn't make sense as I'm saying it out loud. I wanted to be Solicitor General.
Oh, good.
That's why I wanted to go to law school.
That's the government lawyer who argues in front of the Supreme Court on behalf of the government. Yeah. That's a good job.
On constitutional law.
Yeah.
It is a good job. But again, if we think about here's the rub for companies. So it's, you know, sometimes these events happen that are so disruptive, they force us to confront the status quo in a way that can be very productive. So if you think about COVID, which was horrible, COVID forced us to confront things like the use of messenger RNA, which had existed for a long time, but didn't have a business case, and, you know, global supply chain volatility and all different types of things like that. You know, in a way, one of the, you know, this is a horrific change in America. However, not just like abortion aside, this just undermines people's beliefs and institutions even more. And it in a way takes away from what the Supreme Court is and does. The court can't waffle like this, especially. And if you read like Clarence Thomas's opinion, it's even like worse. However, one positive outcome might be that we're forced to confront in a very visceral way what data are being collected and safeguarded. And this could be something that winds up helping Apple in a weird way. I'm actually considering going back to an Apple device.
Really?
Because of differential privacy. Yeah. Yeah. And it could force a change in browser usage. You know, maybe people will switch over to Brave if they can figure out how to use it, you know, or they'll switch over to Safari and they'll
get
off
at
Chrome.
Least with our tech savvy audience, that transition has already occurred. I mean, our audience is very privacy aware. And I would say
this audience is, but I'm talking about my sister, you know? Yeah.
Well, that's where it starts, right? Because your sister then asks you, well, gosh, I want to protect my privacy. How do I do that? And so it starts with the techno savvy who are, you know, very privacy focused. I think there's a general move towards privacy. I was a little bit on the fence saying, well, what's the harm if you're just targeting advertising? The only harm I foresaw is if you had a malicious government that would use the information big tech had gathered about you against you, and now it's happening. So I think now you have a pretty good argument for keeping your stuff private. It's not just about advertising.
One other quick thing. So right now, a lot of digital privacy is decided on by the states. So one of the most restrictive states in the country is Illinois.
They have a biometric restriction, right?
They do. So again, if I start thinking through, let's set aside abortion for a moment, but the knock-on effects of data and tracing, you know, if I'm a business, this is just going to make it very challenging to do business across state lines.
So should businesses just acknowledge, yeah, people want privacy, I guess we should stop?
No, I think now is an interesting moment. First of all, businesses have to really think through their cybersecurity, their data hygiene, all the super sexy stuff that all of us like to think about, but most organizations don't, and certainly not their boards of directors. But I think this is an opportunity to sort of shape the future in a good way.
I agree.
I agree. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's an inflection point. It's uncomfortable. And it's difficult, but it's an opportunity too. And that's the right way to look at it, I think. You know who doesn't want to talk about it? The Chinese government. Apparently, the Shanghai police force left their personal information of a billion Chinese citizens online, unprotected, for a year. And a hacker says, I got them, and I'll sell them. Just a few Bitcoin. The news of this has been suppressed all over China, which makes me think it's a real deal, right? 23 terabytes of data for 10 Bitcoin. The Shanghai National Police database leaked because it was stored. It was secured, but the interface was not. And somebody discovered it. And I guess over the last year has been exfiltrating all those terabytes of 23 terabytes of information. Any reports about this in China are being suppressed. Probably this podcast will now be suppressed in China. I remember being in China watching CNN, and there was a story about Uyghurs. Well, at least I think there was, because CNN just went black for 3 minutes and then came back as if nothing had happened. So maybe if this podcast goes dark for 3 minutes, you'll know why. You lived in China for a long time. What do you think, Amy?
I find this story in a way really hard to believe. If I think through the failure, the system level failures that would have had to have happened, it's really, really bizarre that. It's really bizarre to me that this was this happened.
It was stored on the Alibaba cloud. We've seen S3 buckets be poorly secured on Amazon. I mean, this is not hard to do.
Yeah. So it's a strange story. I will tell you that anybody that was involved in this, their lives are effectively over.
Yeah.
And I follow a couple of, obviously I'm not on Weibo, but I follow some people who have access to Weibo and then, you know, publish what they're seeing. And the lack of, like, this is immediately being censored. Everything is immediately being taken down. I mean, it's kind of China. It's one of these great contradictions, you know, elite hackers are in China and they left their own store unminded is kind of funny.
There's some debate over whether this is accurate data. Some users writing on a cybercrime forum, this is according to the Financial Times, said the data sample included details on picking up packages, suggesting it's just a delivery company's database. The Wall Street Journal said at least some of the information provided was real. And then Changpeng Zhao, who is the chief executive of Binance, tweeted that the company, Binance, had detected the hack and speculated that a government developer had inadvertently posted credentials to access the database in an online forum. So we'll probably
never
know.
The cynical part of me. Yeah, I mean, the cynical part of me, Alibaba is so, you know, there have been lots of problems. And the CCP, the Chinese Communist Party, which runs the government, has really had a magnifying glass in Alibaba and all kinds of problems, like has been causing problems for their executive leadership. Alibaba, as everybody knows, has become this incredibly profitable, formidable company. So another part of, like, a cynical part of me that wonders if this was in sort of the CCP is intentionally doing this, or maybe the hack was somehow from within as a way of knocking Alibaba a little bit more off of its pedestal,
or
sending a signal to Alibaba, or trying to get them to comply.
You just don't know, whatever. Do you? There's wheels within wheels. Let's take a little break. Great to have the three of you. We have lots more to talk about. I'm way behind on commercials because I'm having so much fun talking about this. Our show today brought to you by userway.org, and I am a big fan of this company and what they do. In fact, if you go to the Twit page in the lower right-hand corner, you'll see the little UserWay bug. Click that if you want to see what UserWay can do. You should know the Americans with Disabilities Act requires every website, without exception, to be accessible. They're public entities, and the courts have ruled, no, you've got to be accessible. There was actually a famous case where a pizza company said, well, we have a phone number on our webpage. They could just call that number. And the Supreme Court said, no, you know, that's not it. You got to be accessible. UserWay makes it easy. I think when you're a owner of a business and you hear this, you go, oh, well, that's going to cost a lot. No, UserWay is very affordable. It's an AI-powered solution. It enforces the hundreds of WCAG guidelines, the Web Content Accessibility Guidelines set by the World Wide Web Consortium. And it does it all with one line of JavaScript. In a matter of seconds, UserWay AI can achieve more than an entire team of developers can in months for a fraction of the cost. It's simple, it's easy, it's cost-effective. I know it seems overwhelming, but let me tell you, first step, go to userway.org/twit and use their free scanning tool. Just see how, you know, what issues there are. Is your website ADA compliant? Now, if you have an enterprise-level website, you'll be glad to know, I mean, even, you know, thousands of pages, they have a managed solution. Their team can handle everything for you. In fact, UserWay is used by over 1 million websites. It's easily the number one accessibility solution globally. Coca-Cola, Disney, eBay, FedEx use UserWay and use their enterprise solution. But UserWay also makes its best-in-class enterprise-level accessibility tools available to small and medium businesses as well. For as little as $49 a month, less than I pay for the web fonts on our webpage, you can be fully accessible, ADA compliant, which, by the way, is not just, you know, the law requiring it. It's good for business. You'll reach more customers. You'll build loyalty. We're going to give you 30% off. There are 1 billion people in the world with disabilities, 13% of the population, who can't use your site if you're not accessible. UserWay opens that site up to them. Just think about it. By not being compliant, fines, revenue loss will cost you money. For $49 a month, gain a huge audience. UserWay is the number one accessibility solution, 61% market share, the biggest in the world, on the cutting edge. They work hard to create innovative accessibility technologies. For instance, they've got image recognition that'll automatically generate the alt tags for your images. You can add to it, but it'll get you started. They can remediate complex nav menus, ensure that all pop-ups are accessible. They'll make sure your website uses accessible colors without, you know, changing your color palette while remaining true to your brand. And you'll also get, when you run UserWay, a detailed report of all the violations fixed. And of course, you can always go in there. It makes it very easy for you to adjust, to refine, but it gets you started. Completely platform agnostic. They've got tools that work easily with WordPress, Shopify, Wix, Sitecore, SharePoint, even my little site. A line of JavaScript, it's done. Just ask the voice of Siri, Susan Bennett, what she thinks about UserWay.
Hi, I'm Susan Bennett, the original voice of Siri. You won't hear me say something like this too often. I'm sorry, I don't understand what you're looking for. But every day, that's what the internet is like for millions of people with disabilities. UserWay fixes all of that with just one line of code.
UserWay. It can make any website fully accessible and ADA compliant. With UserWay, everyone who visits your site can browse seamlessly, customize it to fit their needs. It's a great way to showcase your brand's commitment to millions of people with disabilities. Go to userway.org/twit. Get 30% off UserWay's AI-powered accessibility solution, UserWay, making the internet accessible for everyone. And we love it. Thank you, UserWay, for your support. And you support us by going to userway.org/twit. You'll get 30% off. They'll know you saw it here. That's important. So please do that. userway.org/twit. Thank you, UserWay. Speaking of China, Wall Street Journal, big article about the super app. And, of course, they're thinking about Line, WeChat, Weibo, the apps that in Japan and China are... you know, do everything for you. The headline from Christopher Mims, what the heck is a super app and why are Elon Musk, Evan Spiegel, and Jack Dorsey so interested? Tell us, Amy, because you've got an intimate experience with this. What these apps do, why they're so popular in Asia?
I think... from my point of view, I think it's one-stop shopping. So a lot of those apps you can make payments from, you can connect, you can shop, you can do all...
you can buy train tickets, right? I mean...
yeah, you can do all different types of things. You know, and if it's a single interface, I mean, in a way, it's the same reason that Amazon digitally succeeded, right? It was just
one
zero
shop, one
friction.
Shop, one-stop shop, yeah.
Right, right. So I think, you know, and there's... on a lot of these apps, you can perform multiple functions. You don't have to keep switching in and out of things. You don't have to remember different passwords. It's just easier, I think.
When he was talking to Twitter employees, Elon Musk said he wanted to turn Twitter into a WeChat-like super app. Evan Spiegel, CEO of Snap, called Elon's ideas, compelling. In May, Block, of course, Jack Dorsey's company, Nick Molnar told investors the company plans to turn the combination of its Cash App and Afterpay Buy Now Pay Later service into a super app. PayPal said they're going to make a super app. But I have to say, I don't think Americans want a super app. What do you think, Connie? Do we want one app that does it all?
I'm like, I don't want to interrupt Amy, so let her
finish Amy and then you, Connie.
Okay. Oh, sorry. I was just going to say, I absolutely think people want this. I think the problem is market consolidation. I mean, it goes back to like Windows Internet Explorer territory, but the average person making life easier for them, absolutely they want it.
I agree with that, except people want things easier until they find out that it's not good for them, right? Like there's a reason that people use PayPal to pay for purchases across sites because they don't want to log in and give their credit card data. So they definitely want the ease of use. The question that, you know, we face here in the US, because you have so many brands now that have become brands and have built these massive platforms, is who do you trust that you want to work with? Amazon built trust in the early days, to your point, Leo, because of not just one place to do it, but because they had that one-click purchase. Do you remember that?
That was brilliant.
They had.
They owned it.
For
yeah.
many years, right? Yeah. Like it just... what is it? Friction-free shopping. Mm-hmm. So this idea of managing your life and doing a lot of different things, you know, in a friction-free way is great. But then the downside is, do you trust these companies? Do you trust Evan Spiegel or Uber or Elon Musk with all of your purchase history and your data? And we were just talking about when it comes to your healthcare, if they turn over your location data to a state that, you know, threatens them. So it's complicated.
It is.
On the one hand,
and that's my
point. Utility is good.
It's too complicated. It makes it hard to use, right? If it does everything, I mean, then it's. What do you think? You look at consumer tech all the time, Dwight. Do you think Americans anyway are interested in one app that does everything?
You know, I don't know. They've not seen one app that does everything. There are a couple of companies that have made noises that that's what they'd want to do outside of what, you know, you mentioned. Facebook obviously is kind of trying to make its app and along with Messenger and WhatsApp, a Swiss Army knife. You know, they've got a shopping component. They have a messaging component, but it's so, diffused throughout the app and people, I think, go to Facebook for primarily to connect with other people. I don't know that Facebook does it. Apple is kind of quietly building that into iMessage. Some of the features that are coming in iOS 16 kind of have a whiff of that, and they've been, you know, one of the things that they did, I don't think anybody's really taken that much advantage of it, is that they opened iMessage up to companies who wanted to do tech support and other kinds of support through it. And I don't think a lot of companies took advantage of that. So, they've played with it a little bit, but I think a lot of Americans think they want the right tool for the job, and that may not be a Swiss Army knife.
Yeah. I mean, I come from the good old days, the Unix background, where you had one thing that did one little thing, and all you did is had affordances that would allow you to pipe that simple app into another app, into another app, into another app, and kind of build your own super app for one time only. What about the argument that Apple already is the super app, that it's the iPhone? And to your point, Amy, we trust Apple with our privacy. Apple's certainly trying to make it even stronger with application tracking, transparency, and all of those switches. It seems like Apple could do this, they've got Apple Pay, put Apple Pay in every app. Apple could be the back end for it. In a way, that's what your iPhone is, isn't it?
Well, I don't have an iPhone anymore.
Oh, that's right. You're not an iPhone user. You have no idea.
I have other products.
Android is too heterogeneous. Right. It's just a mishmash of stuff.
Right. I think the better way to think about this is open versus closed ecosystems. You know, Apple has so Mac OS, that's what it's called for the mobile devices still, right? Is everything is Mac OS now, right?
Yes.
No. iOS.
Well, no, it's Mac OS for the desktop.
Oh, it's the other way around. Each thing, there's Watch OS, TV OS, Mac OS, okay. iOS, okay. and iPad OS.
Okay.
Everything is, but you're right, underneath, it's all Mac OS.
It's a closed ecosystem, I think, is the difference. So, Apple doesn't always play nicely with third parties. So I think that they are, I would say that what my observation is that Apple is moving more toward making that XOS more closed and more like a super app, at least in terms of its overall offerings. But there is still a core difference. You know, if you're on WeChat, which nobody in the United States is going to be on because it's hard to get an account and you have to speak Chinese.
Did you use it when you were in China?
I have, yeah. Yeah, I mean, my living there predates me, but yes, I have.
Yeah.
And Line, which is a Japanese social media app, which has way less functionality. The place to really look at is China, not Japan or
Some
Korea.
Say it's because, certainly this is true in Japan, people had smartphones before they had PCs.
Oh, well, we had something called a Peachy.
Yeah. I've heard you talk about this before.
Somewhere.
Do you have your Peachy?
I do have my Peachy.
Look for your Peachy.
Let me see
Not
if I
the
can
peachy
find it.
We had in high school with two E's.
No, this was, it actually stood for something and I don't remember. The acronym was Peachy and I don't remember what it stands for now. But it was a smartphone. It didn't have a GUI interface, but it did have like a file tree interface that you moved around with a little tiny mouse.
Right. It was
a
little PC.
Shinkansen tickets on it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Somewhere over here.
I have a picture of one I guess I can show. Here's a young girl in the Harajuku district with her Peachy in 2008.
Mine was even smaller than that. Mine was like a large thumb drive.
Oh, wow.
Small. And there were competing interfaces and competing software and systems. And basically this was like it was like a pretty smart phone at the time that I had it. This was like 1998. So this is going back pretty far.
Before Android, before iOS, this is when Nokia flip phones were ascendant in the US. I think that some of that might have also been why Line and WeChat were so big, because you had to do everything on a small device, right? You didn't have a computer at home.
Well, also, Japan, there's not a lot of English in Japan, so they kind of built their own ecosystem in Line, which I use because I've got friends in Japan. I can't stand. I don't like the interface. I don't understand the stickers, but I think it's an acknowledgement that it would make sense that there's kind of a diaspora of how, connectivity spread and what makes sense in different countries. But the payment part of WeChat and I think is sort of the killer function. It's easy. Everything is integrated. You don't have to click out. The messaging part almost is secondary.
Yeah. I don't want one big monolithic app, but I think if you've got a back end like Apple Pay and face recognition that every app supports, then each app on your iPhone is a part of a larger ecosystem. That's kind of a super app. So in other words, I think the smartphone is the super app in the U.S. Maybe not. I don't know. Have you, Connie, have you ever used WeChat or Line?
I haven't, but I think Amy's point about closed systems is right. I mean, that's the appeal of Apple to people who are not tech savvy,
right,
is that you don't have to be a tech
trust them.
Expert. You just log on, everything works together, and for a long time you didn't have to worry about even viruses and the like. So there's definitely appeal to having that closed ecosystem because it handles a lot of things for you until something goes wrong. And that's one of the questions.
Or until your period tracking app starts selling your information to the Texas Rangers.
I don't see that as, I don't know. I don't see any of these apps willingly. Do you remember the San Bernardino shooting,
yes,
that happened? And,
yes,
and
FBI
Apple
demanded.
And the FBI kind of,
yeah,
got into it.
Yeah.
Right. I just don't. That I see more of that happening. I don't see companies trying to earn a like quick cash by selling, like ratting out women.
I hope not.
You know, and their menstrual cycles. That doesn't make sense to me. I think it more becomes like, can a local authority compel a company to hand over that type of data?
Well, they may not have to because Google and other companies who have this data sell it to data brokers.
Yeah, data brokers.
And,
exactly,
and the investigators go to the data brokers,
right,
and buy it.
For $170.
And so they
bucks.
Don't have to compel anybody.
Right. And that's the thing. It's leaky. Yeah. It's a leaky system because of this data broker thing. And companies are happy to do that. We provide your information to third parties in order to improve our services. Like make a little money on the side.
Yeah.
I mean, that's in every agreement. All right. We're going to take a little break. I do want to talk about Web3 and NFTs. Was that in your Future Today report at the Futures Today Institute?
It was only because we believe that the thing that matters is the underlying infrastructure.
The technology, but, yes.
Yeah. But if I had a nickel for every bro waxing lovingly about his NFT, you know, I would have so many nickels.
And not one NFT. The Future Today Institute.
My nickels would be worth more than that bro's
than
NFT.
Bro. FutureTodayInstitute.com. They publish their tech trends report. 15 years now they've been doing it. It's a really great. You can download it yourself. It's a really great report with lots of information. Amy is not a soothsayer, as she will tell you. She doesn't predict the future, but she talks about strategic trends, and it's really fascinating. Also with us, Connie Guglielmo, who covers the day-to-day to and fro of the tech world as editor-in-chief of CNET, which is a lofty position, and we're thrilled to have you here. The lofty Connie Guglielmo and Dwight Silverman, who is not lofty. He's just cute.
That's been a long time since anyone described me as
he's
cute.
Just cute.
Leo, but
cute.
I'll take it.
Somebody's saying in the chat room you look like their favorite science fiction author. I don't.
Who is that?
I don't know. I have to. He said, I just tuned in the video and my God, it's full of stars. No, he says it's, what did he say? What is, whose name was it? Anyway, I'll find it if I can. Yeah, you look like a well-known science fiction author.
I got to get on that.
Yeah. Our show today brought to you by our fine sponsor, 8 Sleep. Now, Amy, I credit you with getting me on the 8 Sleep train.
I love that. And this is not like a product endorsement or product placement or anything, but I have been sleeping on it for we had a chilly sleep before then. And I don't have their mattress because I like our mattress, but we have the
pod the cover. And, yeah, same thing. Yeah.
I got to tell you, I am sleeping better than I've ever slept in my entire life.
Unsolicited, so ladies and gentlemen.
Totally unsolicited. And I do not sleep well without it.
Yeah.
It has totally, I'm more rested. I'm getting better sleep. My quality of sleep is better. I love this thing.
And you learned about it on the show from Kevin Rose, as I remember.
Yep. Kevin was, yeah. Kevin, like we had a little side chat and he was like, you got to like get one of these.
He was right. We got ours about 8 months ago. And just like you, I'm dreading going on this cruise because I won't have my eight sleep. Good sleep, obviously, so important. And maybe you're lucky, you're young, you sleep like a baby, you don't know yet. But there will come a time in your life where sleep is hard to come by. And it is rotten. It ruins your life. In fact, lots of studies say that good sleep reduces the likelihood of serious health issues. It decreases your risk of heart disease. It lowers your blood pressure. It can even reduce the risk of Alzheimer's. And so many of us, it's estimated 30% of Americans struggle with sleep. You know what the number one issue is? It's too hot or it's too cold. Temperature. That's why we love the 8 Sleep Pod Pro Cover. Yes, they sell a mattress. We happen to have a lovely mattress that we don't want to change. So we got the cover. You put it on any mattress, and it controls the temperature from as low as 55 degrees, which is pretty chilly, or as high as 110 degrees, which is pretty warm. And it changes it through the night. The 8 Sleep Cover actually watches your sleep, and based on your sleep stages, on your biometrics, on the bedroom temperature, it actually reacts intelligently to create an optimal sleep environment. Clinical data shows that 8 Sleep users experience up to 19% increase in recovery, a 32% improvement in sleep quality, 34% more deep sleep. For me, deep sleep is the holy grail. If I can get more than half an hour deep sleep every night, and you can find that out, by the way, from the 8 Sleep app, because it's going to tell you, I know I will have a great day. And if I get less, I will not. That's because that deep sleep is where your brain is recovering. It's the garbage clear out on your brain, getting rid of all those prions and expelling them. It's so important. The 8 Sleep, everybody's different, but I have this complete made-up theory of evolutionary science that I made up, that in history, we've always gone to bed. You know, the fires, we stoke the fire, you go to bed, it's still warm, maybe you even have one of those colonial times, they had those bed warmers, they put some coals in and they put in the... So you go to bed, you're in a nice, warm, cozy bed, you fall asleep. And then over the night, it gets chillier and chillier, which is fine. That's when you go into your deep sleep cycle. And then in the morning, if you're lucky, you get a nice cup of coffee and you wake up. This is in a way to duplicate that experience, what I think we're biologically programmed to. So I have it warm when I get in bed, and then I have the temperature slowly decline as I go into deep sleep. It helps me deep sleep, and then it goes back up again to wake me up. There's even a little vibration that you can put in there so that you gently wake up, which I love. 8 Sleep is amazing. And we're going to get you a very good 4th of July savings, but it's only, you got to go today through July 10th. This is it. This is it. 8 Sleep, EIGHTSLEEP.com/twit. Those 4th of July savings run out today. Cool down this summer with 8 Sleep. They ship to the U.S., Canada, and the U.K. And, this is new, select countries in the EU and now Australia. Woohoo! You got to get this thing.
I have mine set to cook me awake.
Yes.
So I haven't used an actual alarm clock me up outside of my house in over a year.
And
I just wake up.
Cook implies that you're sweating and uncomfortable. It's really nice. It's like, it's getting warm. I'm ready to get, the worst thing, by the way, when it's really hot as it has been this summer, you turn it down a little bit and it's cool and relaxing. And then when it's cold as it was last winter, you turn it up a little bit and it's nice and toasty. You completely control it. There's even a sleep doctor in the app that will notice, always tossing and turning. Let's adjust this. It really works. If you are listening after July 10th, I apologize. This was kind of last minute, but we have a great $150 discount. So you can still get that. 8sleep.com/twit. Check out the Pod Pro cover. That's what Amy and I have. I feel like Kevin might have had the mattress. Because, you know,
I think he had the mattress.
He's
too,
an all-in kind of guy. 8sleep.com/twit. You heard it here. I didn't tell Amy ahead of time. She just volunteered it. I didn't make you, right? I've never met you before. Nothing up my sleeves.
That's right.
Yep. 8sleep.com/twit. We're big fans. Speaking of Kevin Rose, haven't had him on lately because I'm so many of my good friends, people I really trust and respect, have gone down the Web3 NFT rabbit hole. And I want to consult with you all because I don't know. I don't want to promote NFTs. I don't want to promote even cryptocurrency right now on our shows. We've had some crypto advertisers. Well, I'll give you an example. One of them, BlockFi, they have a credit card. You get Bitcoin. They just practically went belly up. They got bought up by FTX, which is going to be the last man standing in all of this. It is estimated $2 billion in hacks this year alone on Web3 projects. What happened? And should I have these guys back on? I mean, Connie, what's your take on Web3 and NFTs and all of that? Cryptocurrency.
Well, there's a difference between the underlying technology and distributed technology as a counter to closed networks, which I think underpins blockchain and NFTs. And then there's crypto and NFTs as a source of scams and concerns and hype. So those are two different things. Obviously, there's a lot of hype and a lot of distrust of people hyping cryptocurrencies and NFTs. And I'm sorry if you bought an NFT for $50,000 and now it's only worth $1,000. I don't know what to tell you. But underlying all of that is a new way of looking at technology in the world that I think a lot of people say is a valid way to
look at it. I hear it, but I'm not convinced of it. Maybe there's some value to blockchain and so forth. Although it's hard to show a compelling need for this. But it's very clear that cryptocurrency is, you know, I just saw a stat which kind of was depressing that the number of black people who own cryptocurrency is like twice as high as white people. Kind of makes sense. Maybe if you're black, you feel disenfranchised. You don't feel like, redlining's been a huge problem. Central banking system, not your friend. So you invest in crypto, Bitcoin primarily. And what happens? You lose your shirt. This isn't social justice. This ends up just being more of the same.
Which is why I say there's a separation that we have to look at. Cryptocurrencies is definitely the wave of the future. And when the U.S. government and governments weigh in and set up government-backed currencies, that's different. But we're in the wild, wild west period. And that's the unfortunate part of this story.
But even stablecoin, which is what governments would presumably stablecoin has not been so stable.
Because there's no regulation. We're still in the wild, wild west of what's going on, right? So people are making up their own rules. There's a lot of hype. There is distrust of government, which is what was driving the whole interest in Bitcoin in the first place. But I think also there is some bad marketing and PR, celebrities hawking things and folks saying, I don't know what it's about, but I missed everything else. So I just want to get in on this, right? So that plays to part of it as well.
Yeah.
Unfortunately,
I will say that financial institutions, because we work with a lot of them, are thinking creatively right now about value creation and, you know, what might the future look like where many things generate value and you can use that value in different ways. What if there was an exchange where there were different types of value that, you know, I think this is like the opening sort of beginning experimentation phase. But if you talk to a lot of people, especially people in tech, about blockchains, you know, oftentimes the use case that people are coming up with for blockchains is like way overly complicated, and existing technology will do just fine. But beyond that, they're, you know, opening, it's just the beginning.
I'll quote a current affairs article from May, which talks to a Berkeley professor, Nicholas Weaver, who says he's a senior staff researcher at the International Computer Science Institute, lecturer in the UC Berkeley Computer Science Department, has been studying cryptocurrency for years. And he says all cryptocurrency should die in a fire. He says cryptocurrencies, although a seemingly interesting idea, are simply not fit for purpose. They do not work as currencies. They are grossly inefficient. They are not meaningfully distributed in terms of trust. Risks involving cryptocurrencies occur in four major areas. And by the way, he wrote this in May, but this has all come true. Technical risks to participants, economic risks to participants, systemic risks to the cryptocurrency system, and societal risks. Man, we're just starting to see the societal risks. He said in a lecture this year, this is a virus. Its harms are substantial. It has enabled billion-dollar criminal enterprises. For instance, I don't think ransomware would be the business it is if it weren't for the easy way to anonymously collect Bitcoin. Going on with his quote, it has enabled venture capitalists to do securities fraud as their business. It has sucked people in. So either avoid it or help me make it die in a fire. So I have also said that argument. Oh, there's the underlying technology. That is of interest. Blockchains of interest. Decentralized ledgers of an interest. Maybe a stable coin, a digital currency for a governmental currency. Maybe that's of interest. But he says, you know, there's nothing good to come out of this. Bitcoin uses the energy of a small to mid-sized country. anyway. Do you want to defend it, anybody? Is he wrong? Should we all be paying attention?
I think that the when this started, when the kind of the recent implosion started, I tweeted that Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies are essentially approaching their true value, which is zero.
Yeah.
There's no true value to them. They are, their value is only what people put into them and are willing to expend on it. But at its base, there's nothing there. And I agree that the whole idea that once governments get in and back it, the reason we believe in the dollar and fiat currencies is that governments back it. There's something there, but there's no there. And it goes up until it approaches its true value, which is zero.
Do you think, Amy, banks will become more decentralized, that the notion of a centralized banking system is a mistake?
No, I don't think that's going to happen. I can't get into too much detail, but we work with banks and key players in the financial ecosystem. We're too deeply entrenched to totally disenfranchise our current banking structure. You could argue, though, does a credit card need to exist in the future if there are other means of transferring and storing value? I think this is, we're just in process on an evolution.
Yeah.
You know, 10 years from now, I could see distributed computing systems in our kitchens where the unused compute from our connected refrigerators are earning fractions of a penny. And maybe our Comcast or, you know, some third party has come in and built a system, where we earn credits back and, you know, everybody's creating value. I think that there are platforms like Roblox that have Roblox, Second Life, they've got currencies within those ecosystems already.
Yeah, maybe the metaverse is going to become the driving force in all this.
I think the biggest winner out of all of this might be China, which is eager to see have an alternative to the dollar as the currency that other currencies are pegged to. So that might be one offshoot, but true decentralization doesn't work within the existing structures of society. So
let me, maybe you are the only person in the world who knows what Web 3.0 is. I'm looking at the page from your trends, Tech Trends 2022. You say Web 3.0 enables people, organizations, and systems around the globe to be seamlessly interconnected while acting independently, allowing for more equitable access to asset ownership and investment. That sounds pretty good.
Yeah, but again, we see this as an evolution. I was actually talking to Dan Sturman, who's the CTO of Roblox, a couple of weeks ago. He's a really real, he's super interesting. He's a super interesting guy, but he had an interesting take on Web3 hype. You know, he said Web3 is a lot like Web1, which is to say infrastructure layer. It's Web4, so the thing that comes afterwards that is in a way more compelling.
Or as Jack That's Dorsey would call it, Web5.
Layer comes in, yeah. So
I guess he just wanted to skip 4 entirely.
I guess.
Do you think governments are hostile to all of this? Because after all,
it
deals them out, doesn't it?
Like, I think like governments have been asleep at the wheel, to be perfect. Many governments, certainly ours. That was not true of China and other governments around the world. In 2020, I was at in Davos, World Economic Forum, and there was a whole entire track on blockchains and cryptos. And at that point, Facebook's currency was still called Lira, right? That was the original name of it.
Yeah, they killed it, but yeah.
They killed it. They killed it shortly after that. But, you know, there was a lot of argument in the room about what they were trying to build. I was in a session after that with the head of Singapore. Singapore was moving ahead on its own CBDC. So I think a lot of governments have been dancing around this, but their interpretation of what's being built, and I think the sort of conversation on Reddit, it's a pretty big chasm.
Well, unfortunately, the conversation on Reddit is what has driven all the markets, right?
Yeah.
And people have lost money, and I could see a world where authentication and provenance is reliable. Where there's a decentralized financial system that isn't dependent on any individual company or even government. I can see the advantage.
Somebody still has to like manage and maintain the pipes. Right. So there is no such thing as true decentralization in the way that I hear people talking about it. Somebody is still making decisions. There's got to be a protocol layer.
Well, that's what you saw with NFTs. If OpenSea delists the NFT, it no longer exists.
Right. So there are entities with control. This is not a controlless, totally egalitarian future. That's not possible.
You wrote this Tech Trends before the crypto crash, but I think this chapter is actually great, and there's a lot of interesting stuff. And so for the people, you know, and I've been very negative about crypto and NFTs and Web3, but that's as it is presenting today. And for people who are curious about what potential it might have in the future, the Tech Trends report is actually very, very valuable. And does I think bring up some very important. We know the cons, brings up the important pros. How about that? Is that fair? Is there anything you would change 6 months later?
I actually did not write that part of the report. One of the people we've got a team that specializes in that. I don't know. I might have. I don't think so. I mean, I think we might have explored other infrastructure more, but it's a snapshot in a moment of time. The NFT piece of this doesn't change. Tokens are still a thing, and they matter. I think the current modality, which is digital collectibles, is ultimately what changes going forward. I think the sort of FOMO attached to all of that is what drove. Yes. The volatility and what also crashed it back down.
Yes.
So.
Yeah. That's really my criticism. People who are flogging it. And really most of them stand to gain. You know, when you once you invest in this stuff, you got to get somebody else to buy it or it's not worth anything. And as it starts to crash, then you really have to get somebody to buy it. So the drumbeat gets louder and louder.
Yeah, I got to say, Leo, between our earlier conversation about Elon Musk and now bashing crypto bros and NFTs, I'm assuming we're all going to get a lot of really loving messages on social media this week.
I have good news for you.
Everybody's going to be like, hey, this was awesome. Thank you so much for this show this
week. Here's the good news. By now, those people have abandoned ship. They're not listening to our shows anymore.
They are hate listening to us.
Maybe they're
right
hate
now.
Listening. You think
that
they're hate
what's
listening?
Happening.
Why I ought to. Well, how about
I'm
this?
I'm glad I'm off. I'm glad I'm taking my break.
Don't answer any email or don't visit Twitter and be careful what your at replies say. Close your DMs. At least you'll be able to get Starlink on your yacht for mere $5,000 a month.
Yeah, and you can listen to Hall & Oates.
On your yacht rock?
Yacht rock. Yeah.
Starlink. So I here's another example of me being a complete wide-eyed optimist, Pollyanna, now faced with the facts. I thought Starlink was going to bring internet access to every corner of the globe. It was going to transform the world by making internet access widely available at a low cost. I guess Elon had a different plan.
Are you feeling sad for all the yacht owners that their internet is going to cost $5,000?
No, they can afford it. If you own a yacht, $5,000's nothing.
Are you upset that it's not free for the yacht people?
I mean, I would be thrilled if Elon would then take that money and then offer Starlink for free in areas where people are underserved. I don't see him doing that, but
well,
maybe.
All of Roger, like Canada is completely offline as we speak.
Canada
so, like,
would be good.
Starlink exists there. Maybe he can flip a switch and be the salvation that the Canucks need.
I have to say he has come through in a number of places where it's been incredibly valuable to have Starlink. The fires, when we had the wildfires up here, where was it? Haiti, that he offered Starlink.
Ukraine.
Yeah. He's put in terminals. So let's encourage Elon. I take everything back. It's fine. Make $5,000 a month off every yacht in the ocean, as long as you provide terminals for low cost in areas that are underserved. That would be good.
And it's $5,000 a month after you spend $10,000 on the hardware.
Oh,
that's not. First, there's you got to buy the. Okay. Upfront hardware for $10,000, and then it's $5,000.
You know, I'm just bitter because I was really looking forward to a day where I could live on a boat and do this show, and that ain't going to happen.
Didn't Starlink also just release a version aimed at RV owners?
Yeah. Yeah, so yeah, they're
how much
moving,
is that? How much is that?
I don't know. Initially, the idea of Starlink was you had to have a fixed address, but they always promised that at some point they would be able to do it in mobile environments. Let me look. Starlink for RVs. Let's see how much it costs right now.
$600 for the hardware.
Nothing.
And then $135 a month.
So it's a little more expensive than land-based non-mobile Starlink, which, by the way, whose price has gone up. It is now $110 a month. But for an extra $25, you could be driving around in your RV. I think there's a market for that.
That's not a bad price, actually.
No. And it's pretty fast. Although people with Starlink who've been owners for a long time are saying that while the price is going up, the speeds are going down, I guess, as more people are using it. Of course, they're launching more satellites. They're launching satellites tonight. In a couple of hours, they're going to launch some satellites. So there are more Starlink on your yacht, so hot, writes TechCrunch. Thank you, Andrew Mendez, for that headline. let's see. The Mac Studio shows the power of the M1 chips, but is not for mere mortals, says Dwight Silverman. I love my Mac Studio, but you're right. It was a little expensive.
Yeah, I got an email from a friend of mine who, after reading this, who had just bought one, and he almost like gave me a spreadsheet amortizing it out over time, how much he says he's 68 and it's the last machine he'll buy. And so it was worth it to him. I look at it and it was a really impressive system, And it certainly is fast, but, and if you're a creative and if you're rendering video or creating, you know, animation or doing something where you really need that power, it's, you know, it's a great machine. But just for everyday use, for the way most people use, a Mac, it's probably way overkill. What's really interesting, I thought, when they launched this, and they still haven't done it, is they have not kind of really updated the Mac Mini, which I think is eventually is coming, but it is going to it will be the machine I'd be even more interested in, particularly if they do a lot of the ports on the back end. I have a 27 inch iMac, the last Intel iMac.
Oh, it's time to get rid of those. That's for sure.
Oh, I love it.
You love it.
I couldn't wait. Yes. Yes. And I couldn't, I mean, just doing stuff day to day, I can't tell any difference between the Mac Studio and this machine. And I like an all-in-one better, kind of the size, the bulk of the Mac Studio on my desk was kind of annoying when you're used to it all-in-one. I'm really hoping for a 27 inch,
there is a
Apple
rumor
silicon machine
of an iMac Pro coming around the corner.
Yeah, I'll spin for that.
I think that's the secret that nobody in no tech reviewer really wants to admit, which is most users can't tell the difference between any of this stuff. All of the differences are in benchmarks. You could tell the difference in price.
Yes. And Apple has a really good opportunity for gaming here that either they're blowing or they can't convince developers to jump on it quickly enough. But these machines would be great for high-end, you know, AAA gaming, and you're just not seeing it yet. And,
because Apple, it's kind of they've now abandoned NVIDIA and Radeon cards, so they have to provide the GPU that'll do it. Developers don't want to learn a new, you know, have to start writing the Metal instead of DirectX or whatever they're using, OpenGL. I think Apple has gone its own way. They've taken that fork in the road, and it's going to be up to them to get game developers to follow. But I think that's
well, and they do have game developers working on iOS games,
casual games. You bet they own it. They own them.
Yes, and there are some really good 3D games and action games for the iPhone and the iPad, and those, you know, try porting those over to an M1 chip and see what happens. I think if you had a hit there, that could be really interesting.
We will, of course, talk about this on MacBreak Weekly on Tuesday with our brand new panel member. I'll let you tune in Tuesday to meet that person. But there have been some criticisms of Apple's latest chip, the M2, on Friday. Orders began for the MacBook Air based on the M2 chip, a redesign in four colors. And almost immediately, the ship dates went out a month. I'm sure they're out even farther now, which means probably Apple's just subject to the same supply chain issues that every other PC manufacturer is subject to, finally. But there have been some complaints about the heat problems with the M2. So it'll be interesting to see as more and more of these M2 based computers, the MacBook Pro 13 inch and the MacBook Air, come out, how people respond to that. But we'll talk more about that on Tuesday. Apple is in very active bidding. They added Friday Night Baseball. They're in very active bidding to get NFL Sunday Ticket. The commish, is it still Roger Goodell, says we'll know. Yeah, Roger Goodell. He says we'll know by this fall of the fate of NFL's Sunday Ticket. But he does say, I really believe we'll be moving to a streaming service. In other words,
it is hard to over describe how devastating this is to broadcast media.
No kidding.
We have worked with and advised some of the networks, and the amount of money that this brings in, these are long contracts. So the talk about like not being willing to confront your cherished beliefs. A couple of years ago, we said, hey, what if a streamer wins out during the next contract renegotiation, and just like none of them would hear of it. It was
really,
it wasn't just like incomprehensible. It was like silly.
It's inconceivable.
Right.
Yeah.
right? The devastation that this is going to result in for networks is like, there's no way to sugarcoat it.
It's really an interesting way for Apple to become a player here. Reports are that it's $2 billion a year. DirecTV.
Yeah, they're going to overpay.
They're going to overpay. DirecTV bought it some years ago for $1.5 billion. Sunday Ticket's important because aside from the games you can see on your local markets, in your local broadcasts, if you want to see any other games, you need Sunday Ticket. Serious football fans, this is a big, big deal.
Right. And what's happening is what used to be scarcity in the market, you know, doesn't exist anymore. And so for sports, especially where you kind of want to see the game when it's on, or where, you know, the amount of money that they're able to make, especially from streamers right now, which are looking for additional differentiators, is like insane. Insane.
And presumably the NFL at some point will do their own app, right? Major League Baseball.
MLB has a super app.
Yeah.
I think you guys know I'm a baseball fan.
Yeah. It's a horrible experience. Yeah.
It's as bad of as an experience as continuing to sit through 9 innings in the year 2022. So terrible.
Wait a minute, I thought you were a baseball fan.
I am a baseball
fan.
What
do you want to
have
a 6 innings?
Daughter, that the game is too.
It's too long.
It's time to modernize.
Yeah,
it's too long. We probably don't need 9. We could have a whole separate conversation.
I'm with you. I love baseball. I've been a baseball fan since youth, since childhood.
Right.
And even I by the eighth inning, it's like, give me another beer. I can't.
Right.
Where's the hot dog? I'm in a coma.
I took my daughter. I was very excited because I grew up with the Cubs, and the Cubs were in Baltimore, so we went to it. That's exciting. The only place you can see the Cubs is at
the Orioles
in Baltimore, where literally nobody goes to see the Orioles.
Right.
She was just, you know, she was totally done. Like second inning, she was just done.
Wow.
Anyways, but the app is terrible. Could the NFL make more in a DT, like a direct to consumer play? Probably, but a lot of that overall revenue is still coming from advertising. So
even cricket is attempting to modernize and cut the games down from 2 or 3 days to a mere a few hours. Our attention span is getting awfully short. I don't know if anybody under 25 has the patience to sit at a 9-inning, 3-hour baseball game, especially because football, even though, honestly, somebody did the math, there's only 11 minutes of action in a 3-hour football game. At least there's action. It's just somehow more exciting. And, of course, the networks are very good at producing it. Amy, have you watched any of the Apple Friday Night Baseball broadcasts as a baseball fan?
No, I haven't.
They're terrible. They're terrible.
Yeah.
They're awful. They make them slower, even more boring. Hard to believe.
I mean, I grew up in a household where WGN was on constantly.
Oh, wow.
And so there was, you know.
And that was when the Cubs had lost for decades.
We're terrible like
they
are
the
right
worst.
Now.
They were the worst. But that's it. A long-suffering Cubbies fan.
Yeah.
One of the highlights of my baseball life is going to Wrigley and watching what's his name? Practically fall out of the booth during the seventh inning stretch.
Harry Carey.
Take me out to the ball. By the seventh inning, Harry Carey, 6 sheets to the wind. He would lean out the booth and lead the fans in singing it. And every time, he looked like he was going to just fall out. I mean, he was just, I want to hear you. Great Harry Carey. But that's Chicago baseball. That's a great sport. Connie's wisely.
Apple's announcers are just horrible.
Oh, they killed it.
And if I were the NFL, that would give me pause.
Well, I think the NFL hires them. I don't think Apple hires them. I don't know what's going on.
You mean MLB
on.
Hires them?
I mean MLB, not NFL. Yeah, wouldn't that be funny? Yeah. MLB, those are MLB employees, I believe.
What makes them so bad? I'm curious.
Oh, they're just... You know, I've watched 2 games and only part of the games, and I wound up turning the sound off so I didn't have to hear them because they were awful. I just used subtitles. I watched a couple of Astros games, and they talk about themselves more than the game. Everything is, you know, relatable and personable. And I don't want to hear that. I want to hear details about the players. Right. I want to hear backstories. But you don't get that. You get kind of how they feel about the game.
Apple, and I guess MLB is trying to appeal to the millennials. So these are young. There's two women and two guys. They're very young. By the way, this is very Apple. ESPN on the mic flags would have a big, legible ESPN. Can you read what's on these mic flags?
No.
Mm-mm.
I have to think that there's an enormous amount of data that went into selecting people, and I'm sure that
more data than sense.
Right.
That's the problem.
Listen, if it attracts more young people to the sport, great, because it's effectively going to die. Otherwise, there's just not enough young people who are. My kid won't watch it. You know, it's long, it's boring.
Yeah. Somebody in the IRC says the only way kids watch baseball these days is they watch the highlights on their Amazon Echo.
Yeah,
that's pretty much it.
That's pretty much how people watch most sports.
Everything, sports, life, everything. Yeah, I just want the highlights. I don't have time. All right, one more break, and then we're going to wrap things up. You guys are very patient. My problem is when I've got a great panel, I just don't want to stop. And you guys are fantastic. Amy Webb, Future Today Institute, Connie Guglielmo, Editor-in-Chief, CNET, EIC at CNET. You go. You got the new logo on there, up there on the sign. Did you have to revamp all your logoage in your house too?
Well, that's the only logoage in my house.
Okay.
But yes, we did have to revamp the whole logo.
So what's the reaction been? Because I have to say, you know, I worked for CNET when it was Halsey Miner and, you know, Shelby and just a couple of people. He was the guy who came up with that CNET. This is a big deal redesign at CNET.com. What's the reaction been?
I mean, you have your people who love it and people who hate it. But for the most part, people have liked it because they think it's kind of retro and kind of forward looking.
Like this, when you refresh the page, it wrote, ooh, cool.
They like to see the line go that was dating us, I guess. It's still red. Still seeing that. We didn't change the name. So.
You know, at first, I'll be honest, I wasn't crazy about it, but I like the clean, kind of open nature of the page now. It breathes a little bit more. It's good. It's very modern, I feel.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. What's the name of this font?
Oh, it was created for us. I can't remember what it's called off the top of my head. I'll look it up and let you know.
The headline font is unique. You have a Helvetica for the
serifs.
Yeah, but it's an interesting serif font.
It almost looks like a derivation of the old Rolling Stone font.
Oh, maybe. By the way, I have to turn this off. I'm running an extension called Toucan that translates random words into Spanish on every web page. So I apologize. Usually I turn it off before the shows. CNET is not half Spanish now. It's just me. That's just my. Also with us from the Houston Chronicle and Authory.com, Dwight Silverman. Great to have you, as always, my dear friend.
Always great to be back.
Our show today brought to you by Worldwide Technology. These are the last. This was great. The last place Lisa and I went, March 2nd, 2020. This flu that's going around. It'll be all right. We flew to St. Louis and saw WWT. And actually, I'm really glad. In fact, as soon as the pandemic lets up, sometime within the next 5-6 years, we were going to go back to St. Louis because I want to visit the Advanced Technology Center. This was the coolest place we saw. Worldwide Technology, they sell enterprise technology, and at the heart of what they do is their Advanced Technology Center. They started building this a decade ago because, of course, their engineers needed to try new enterprise technologies. They needed to spin up proofs of concept. They needed to do integration so that they could advise their clients on what's good, what's bad, what works, what doesn't work, what works with what you've got. Now the ATC, I mean, it's just grown from its several buildings now. It is a research and testing lab that brings together more than $500 million in enterprise technology from the big OEMs and the little disruptors. It's exactly what you need if you are adding technology or adding to your technology stack in enterprise. And here's the best part. You can use it just like those WWT engineers use it. The ATC offers hundreds of on-demand and schedulable labs featuring solutions that include technologies represented by the newest advances in cloud and security and networking, primary and secondary storage, data analytics and AI, DevOps and so much more. When we were at the ATC, it's just rack after rack of the coolest, latest stuff all lit up. It's really cool. I asked the engineers, you love working here? They said, this is a dream job. We get to work with the latest stuff. I said, what's that over there? There was a whole, like three racks in a cage, completely isolated. Oh, they said, that's where we do our AV and ransomware testing. That is completely isolated from the rest of the building. You have to get special permission to go in there. But that's how committed they are. They actually built a whole area just so they could try security solutions. With ATC, you can do the same. You can test out products and solutions before you go to market. It's not just the labs. It's technical articles, expert insights. They've got demonstration videos. They've got white papers, all the tools you need to stay up to date with the latest technology. This is why people, when they start using WWT, they never stop. This is a trusted partner that's with you. They understand that business is about strategy, not technology, but technology supports the strategy. They're very clear. They understand that. So they come in and they help you completely fulfill your business purpose by choosing the right technology. It's strategy first. I think this is so fantastic, and I'm so glad they've made this available. You don't even have to go to St. Louis. It's available anywhere in the world, 365 days a year. While you're at the website, by the way, check out the events they've got going on. We did a panel. It was so much fun. When we go back, we'll do another panel. Communities. Lou Maresca, who does our This Week in Enterprise Tech, just recently did a panel at WWT. It's a great way to learn about technology trends, hear the latest research and insights from their experts. Whatever your business needs, WWT Worldwide Technology can deliver scalable, tried and tested, tailored solutions. They are the partner you want, the part you need that could bring strategy and execution together to make this exciting new world happen. To learn more about WWT, the Advanced Technology Center, to get access to all these resources, absolutely free. Did I mention that? Absolutely free. Go to WWT.com/twit. You create that free account. It's all there for you. WWT.com/twit. We thank these guys. We love these guys. I can't wait to go out in St. Louis, have some fried ravioli again. WWT.com/twit. We brought Mary Jo Foley last time. I think we're going to have to bring Paul next time. WWT.com/twit. Thank you for your support. We had a great week this week on Twit. You know what? Let's take a look at this little movie we made here. The two tech guys are Leo Laporte here.
And Micah Sargent here.
Micah will be all on his own next week, so please help him.
Be kind.
All your printer questions next week with Micah Sargent.
Previously on Twit. Mac Break Weekly.
The best advice I can give is the advice we always give, and that is if you buy a new Mac, put it through everything you're going to do. Put it through the hardest things you're going to do, and if you have any problems, take it back. But like do your workload.
Tech News Weekly.
They created a new type of feature for the iPhone, the iPad, and the Mac that they call lockdown mode. And what it does is it basically puts an extreme security measure on your phone. They're trying to kind of reduce the attack surface, is what they call it, that could be used to target at these individual people.
This Week in Google.
You actually asked the artificial intelligence GPT-3 to write an op-ed.
I asked it to write three things. I asked it to write an op-ed about moral panic. Then I asked it to write a short story with a hero about moral panic. And then I asked it to write a blurb for my book about moral panic.
Moral panic over the internet is nothing new. In the early days of the internet, people were concerned, quote, that children would be exposed to pornography and violence.
Twit.
It never ends that quote, by the way.
That sounds just like Mr. Jarvis.
Yeah. The laziest man in literature. He's just going to let GPT-3 write everything from now on. That was an interesting piece on Tech News Weekly about lockdown mode. Ian Scher writing for CNET, Apple lockdown mode, a new level of security for your iPhone. This is kind of going along the line of what we're talking about and making Apple, kind of the trusted place for all your stuff. I don't know if they expect everyone to use it. It's really for people who are targeted by things like Pegasus, the NSO group's, very, very powerful zero-click hack. Any thoughts, what's your thought, Connie, on lockdown mode? Is this...
Well, this is Apple really just, like you said, trying to own the market for privacy on a device. And, it's been going on for many years. The San Bernardino trial that we mentioned, when they stood up to the government and said, we won't share data because we believe in privacy, that, it's been a long, long time coming, all of this message. Lockdown mode is like the extreme, right? It prevents you from even hooking up with utilities or peripherals. It really is lockdown mode. I mean, the name says it all right there. But it allows Apple to really put a very strong stake in the ground that they don't just talk about privacy, that they're doing something about it. And lockdown mode is coming in the next version of the mobile operating system for the iPhone, which is in September, iOS 16.
Will you turn it on?
I will definitely turn it on to see what it's like.
Yeah.
How intrusive it is. If I'm constantly getting asked, to turn it off, or I can't do things, day to day, then I would evaluate. But sure, I would definitely turn it on and see what it's like.
In fact, it looks like it turns off some of the things that Apple touts as a convenience feature: the ability to share things with your computer and your phone. So here's what Apple says: lockdown mode will do. Most message attachments are blocked. Features like link previews are disabled. We know that is probably how the NSO group got into the phones of the dissidents and the journalists and the bad guys too. That Pegasus was used against. Messages is a big open hole. Web technologies like just-in-time JavaScript compilation are disabled. Google did a study actually of just-in-time JavaScript, found that most browser security flaws were as a result of JIT compilation of JavaScript. And I think Google offers on Chrome a way to turn it off, but it sure breaks a lot of things. Incoming invitations and service requests like FaceTime calls are blocked, but only if you've never called the person before. I will hope that Apple makes this granular enough that I could just turn that on. I don't know this person. I don't want to hear from them.
We're all going to be beta testing it, right? Yeah. iOS 16 beta is coming out shortly, or the public
preview
beta
is coming
of it.
Out. Yeah.
Yeah.
This month,
very shortly.
Yeah.
And so then, we'll do all the beta testing for Apple as usual.
Shared albums in photos removed. Again, a feature Apple touts, tells people about it. WWDC, look, you can share your photos. Mm-mm. Any new invitations for shared albums? Blocked. Sorry, Mom. Any wired connections between your phone and computer or accessory? Blocked. Configuration profiles like the ones for Apple public betas cannot be installed. So you just said maybe we could do this in the public beta. I'm thinking as soon as you turn it on, you can't use the public beta.
I don't know.
We'll find out.
Yeah.
And you can't
update to the next version.
You can't. Yeah, right. Your device cannot enroll in mobile device management. Amy?
Does that mean that like third-party testing apps? I'm trying to remember the name of it. It was
TestFlight
or something.
TestFlight.
TestFlight.
Yeah. Does that mean that doesn't work anymore?
Yeah. Plus, for instance, I use a really great service, NextDNS, that's a DNS provider, but also does a lot of malware blocking. In order for it to work on an iPhone, I install a profile. You download the profile. Apple says, you want to allow this? You do. That's gone. But those things are inherently dangerous. You have to really know this is from the person who said, and I trust this person. And because it's that thing, same with mobile device management, MDM. In fact, remember, one of the parental blocking tools on the Apple Store got in trouble because they were using MDM, which is intended for enterprise environments, not for child protection. They were using MDM, and Apple got mad at them, pulled it out, then put it back, said, sorry. It's been controversial. So lockdown mode will be any Apple device that can run iOS 16, iPad OS 16, or Ventura. Oh, sounds like you can run it on your desktop too. I don't think
on your Apple Silicon desktop.
Yeah, M1. I don't think any of us are targets of. Well, maybe you are, Amy. Actually, you should run it. You're probably a target of a nation state.
I don't know.
When you go to the Pentagon, they take your phone, right?
Depends on where I go. Sometimes, during COVID, I'm not
You can't go anywhere.
Still kind of remote. But yeah, if I go into a skiff, there's a little lockbox thing outside the room and everybody has to put all their devices into it. Which I've always felt uncomfortable about because then it's like, well, who else has a key to this? But, you know, I don't think I'm interesting enough for anybody to be truly surveilling in that way. So
I don't know. I don't know if they're just watching your location. They're thinking this woman has access to
this
some...
woman spends a lot of time at Rita's getting soft serve ice cream.
Did you? OK,
that's what they're thinking.
So
why isn't she heavier?
Let's go to Rita's.
As they get your health data.
Let's go to Rita's. Wasn't there a snack shop inside the Pentagon?
Oh, there's actually a whole, the Pentagon's huge, and there's actually a ton of restaurants. Food is pretty bad. There's a dry cleaner. There's everything you need, and you know, inside of it.
They actually closed it. I remember the story. It was called Cafe Ground Zero. And it was a little, here's a picture. I think here's a picture of it. Let me see if I can find it. Here it is. It was a little, oh, shoot. The web is crumbling. It was, yeah. Well, maybe our firewall is blocking me or not letting me go to archive.defense.gov. But here's a little thumbnail. Here's a little thumbnail. It was a little snack shack, a hot dog stand right in the middle.
Yeah.
And remember, the reason they closed it is because satellite images would show U.S. military officers going in and out at the same time every day. And the Soviets thought it was the most secret meeting room in the whole Pentagon.
So that's a true story. And it's in the center park area outside.
It's not in the ring? It's not inside the ring?
Yes. It is inside.
It is inside. That's why.
Yeah.
The Soviets said, oh, whatever this is, must be. There's a bigger picture. This is from wearethemighty.com. All the officers go in there at noon every day. Must be important. It is said, get this, the Soviet Union had at least two nuclear missiles pointed at it at all times.
Hot dogs are dangerous.
Hot dogs can kill you. That's the
message. They can and will kill you.
I'm mad at my wife because she told me the other day that every hot dog I eat takes 30 minutes off my life. That just spoiled it for me. Let's see. What else? Anything else we should talk about before we wrap? Oh, Tuesday. Very exciting. James Webb, fully unfurled, will be... I think they've already sent the pictures back. I think NASA's just being coy. But
there's
NASA,
a live stream.
Is it a live stream?
There'll be I think it's like at 10:30.
9:30 our time, 12:30 your time.
It's a presentation.
I'm sorry, 7:30 Pacific.
Eastern.
I know because I have to get up really early. We're going to stream it. Rod Pyle, our spaceman, and I will stream coverage of the NASA event Tuesday, 10:30 Eastern, 7:30 Pacific. With the first images from the James Webb,
I think it's so cool. I mean, this is like,
so cool.
It's such an, there's so much happening, but this is like one of these incredible moments that
it's good, man.
We're going to be alive to see this happen. It's literally going to change reality.
Yeah. This is actually what I was saying to Rod this morning, is that for all the bad stuff we talk about all the time, and I've kind of made a pledge to myself to start putting some more positive stuff, but we are on a very interesting time for science. So the Webb telescope is so good that it's going to be able to take the most distant pictures ever taken in the universe so far away that this is light that is only about 120 million years older than the beginning of the universe. We're essentially going to be able to see the very earliest right after the Big Bang moments of the universe. Fascinating. Can't wait. We're going to see that too. And then the particle accelerator lab at CERN has just turned on the Large Hadron Collider for the third time with even more power than before. And they're already finding mysterious particles. Although there was some concern, I remember on Reddit, among some people, that the end of the world was nigh. That, you know, they were going to discover something that was going to cause the universe to collapse or something. I'm happy to say that did not happen.
Yet.
Oh! For the last 3 years, engineers have been upgrading the collider so it could detect more data, run at higher speeds. It's running at the highest energy level ever, 13.6 trillion electron volts. So we live in, yes, Amy, thank you. We live in exciting times. And I am thrilled to have had this time together with you. Amy Webb, Future Today Institute. I feel like I kind of pressured you into doing this show. I just want to apologize.
Didn't pressure. I love being here all the time. I get to meet cool people.
You're so busy.
You to speak in a Russian accent.
Yes, it's right.
Where else would I be?
The wonderful Amy Webb. She's great. I've been watching lately the chess tournaments, the World FIDE Chess Candidates Tournament just ended to pick the next challenger for Magnus Carlsen in next year's World Championship match. It will be Nepomniachtchi, the Russian, except he doesn't play under the Russian flag because no one does anymore, except he's Russian. So you know he's Russian, but he has to play under some fake. It's so silly. It's like the Olympic athletes. They play under some. Oh, he's not Russian. He's playing under the FIDE flag. But as a result, I'm seeing a lot of Russian commentators. And I'm afraid my Russian's gotten worse.
Sounds pretty good to me.
Well, that's right, because you don't speak Russian. My favorite person to watch is Judith Polgar, who's a very famous, greatest woman grandmaster of all time. Her father was a chess trainer who took her and her sister and forced them to study chess their whole childhood. But it paid off. She's very good. Anyway, she has, I think she's Hungarian or Polish or something, Eastern European. So her accent a little different. Thank you, Amy Webb. Please come back. I promise not to. I promise no more pressure, no more DMing you on the Twitter saying, please come on the show, please. Thank you, Amy. And my regards to Brian. Thank you for your family for letting us have you for this Sunday evening. Same to you, Connie Guglielmo. She's editor-in-chief of CNET. Give us something to plug. What's hot and happening on CNET now? Anything new?
Well, we're getting ready to see if Amazon's going to deliver on Prime Day, which is coming up this week. People looking for deals, because everyone is looking for a deal. The economy is bad. If you want a robot vacuum, this might be the week.
I forgot to mention Prime Day. Are you like the Wire Cutter and Wired Magazine? Everybody, they all, and I remember I'm more used to this. It's like all hands on deck. They work 24/7 for 3 days, rating all the Prime Day. Are you going to do that?
Yeah, we have a team 24/7 because we have offices around the world. So,
oh, well, that's good.
We just are doing handoffs from time zone to time zone.
It's already started 1 minute ago. Amazon Prime Day 2022, best deals so far, posted 1 minute ago at CNET.com. Jared DePayne, he's working.
I have to say, I've already bought my voice activated light bulbs. They were on sale.
Oh, nice. You remember Amazon had these first day gadgets that you could order, and they wouldn't make them all, just the ones that most people ordered. I ordered a Amazon thermal printer that prints out sticky notes from my Amazon Echo. I ordered it like a year ago. Finally came the other day. It's like, wow, look at that. So well, now I can say, Madam A, print my shopping list. And it goes,
I was going to say, it's a safe bet that anything that Amazon makes is going to be on sale.
Yeah.
So I would just hold off and check.
Best Prime Day deals. We'll go to CNET.com to get all those best Prime Day deals. Prime Day begins July 12th, Tuesday. So there's two things to look forward to. Pictures of the stars at the farthest end of the galaxy and Prime Day deals. Mr. Dwight Silverman. He tries to retire. Every time he's on, he's trying to retire. They never do let him. He writes it, of course, the Houston Chronicle. They won't let him go. They won't let him stop. And you can get all of his stuff at Authory, Authory.com/D Silverman. Is it 30 years of columns there?
It goes back pretty far.
Wow.
You know, it picks up the old cron.com stuff. It picks up the stuff from my old blog. In fact, when I'm looking for something, I go there and search for it instead of on the Chronicle's website. By the way, I want to say that I have been on with a lot of panels, and Amy and Connie are my favorite. I really enjoyed this. And when all of us should get together again and do this as the same panel,
okay.
I really like it.
You know, we don't normally do that, but I think, you know, sometimes it clicks and we go, oh, we got to have them back again. And this is definitely one of them. So good suggestion. Thank you, Dwight. We'll note that down in my little notebook. In my Emacs org mode journal. I'll write that right down. Dwight Silverman, Connie Guglielmo, Amy Webb, thank you so much. Thanks to all of you for watching. Be silly for us to sit around talking if nobody were watching. We do twit. And you can watch us do it live every Sunday about 2 p.m. Pacific, 5 p.m. Eastern, 2100 UTC, the live stream, audio and video at live.twit.tv. People watching live like to chat live at irc.twit.tv, unless you're in the club. If you're a special person and you're in Club Twit, we've got our very own Discord, which is really fun, a great social network. You get that access to that. All the animated GIFs you can eat. You also get ad-free versions of all the shows because you're giving us $7 a month. So we give you ad-free versions of all the shows and the Twit Plus feed with unique stuff. Please, if you're not yet a member of Club Twit, you can join monthly $7. You can join an annual plan, $7 times 12. We have corporate memberships. It really helps us keep making great programming. And I think now more than ever, we really appreciate your support. twit.tv/clubtwit. We'd love it if you'd join. But don't worry, free versions of the show ad supported will always be available at twit.tv. There's a YouTube channel for every show. In this case, it's youtube.com/thisweekintech. You can also subscribe in your favorite podcast client. You get it automatically that way for free, audio or video. There is a fee. I have a little request. If you do have a podcast client that has reviews, could you leave us a 5-star review? We've been doing This Week in Tech since 2005. We are almost 18 years old now, and there's some people who forgot we even exist. I get this all the time. Joe Rogan was just on Joe Rogan. Leo Laporte, is he still working? Is he still alive? So leave a 5-star review. Let the world know This Week in Tech is still going strong after 18 years. Thank you, everybody. And I hope you come back again next week. Another twit.
It's amazing.